Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome to Pulling Heartstrings with the Matriarch here on your number one talk radio station, Eagle FM. Ladies and gentlemen, hi, how you doing? My name is the Matriarch and today is the 18th of the 12th month, 2025. It is a Thursday evening and the time is 5 minutes past the hour of nine. Now, you guys have been missing me. Yes, it is. You guys have been missing me. Mara, your girl is going through things. Your girl is going through things. And what are these things if not the things that I would like for us to talk about? So I've always pictured myself to be a public person. Fairly. I've always pictured myself to be one of those bubbly people, one of those people that, you know, I know a lot. And I know symptoms and I know signs and I know so much, right? But I think it is, it's really one of those learning moments where it's like, yeah. So ladies and gentlemen, the number in studio is 083-288-401. And I would just like to talk about, something. Nah? It is called MDD. MDD. Now, do you have a guess what that is? Like, in your mind, do you have a guess on what that is? I don't think so. Because, I mean, like, what's MDD? You know, Master of Dancing Distractions? No. Major depressive disorder. That is MDD. Now, ladies and gentlemen, Mugel over here, Umatriarch, has been diagnosed with MDD, major depressive disorder. And I was diagnosed on Monday. Now, I've been feeling all kinds of off lately. I've been feeling all kinds of, like, you know, I'm very self-aware, so I know when something's just not right with me. And I'm like, but what is it? What is it? What could it possibly be? Because, right? I'm getting out of bed every morning. And that's why I say that let's talk about our mental situation. Let's talk about what we're thinking, what we're feeling. Let's talk about it so that some way, somehow, right, we can find the assistance that we need. Because it goes south very quickly and it goes faster than you think. And then next thing you know, you are locked up. Eh? You are locked up and you did something bad and it is just a bad situation for you. But all the signs were there. All the signs were there. So I've recently, Monday, I haven't been feeling quite well. I've been feeling a little demotivated. I've been feeling a little off. I've been feeling a little sad here and there, but I didn't deem it to be something big. I didn't deem it to be something, that was something big in my life. I didn't picture it to be like, oh my goodness, it is maybe depression, because I've been depressed before and it's nothing like the way I am right now. Because Vele, when we picture depression, we're like, you are sleeping. And also one thing is that we assume because we've had it before, it must be the same all the time, right? And that's my learning opportunity, because it's not the same. It's not the same. The depression that you get, it's not the same as the depression that you get in your 20s, or the depression that you get in your 30s, or the depression that you get in your 50s. It's not the same. It depends on what it is. It depends on what happened. It depends on what's not happening. It depends on how the situation is, where you're at, and how you deem, how you are coping with the situation, right? Because new life challenges also develop into new life ailments, you know? So I would have depression. I wouldn't think that I would have major depressive disorder. It was the last thing on my mind. Honestly, it was the last thing on my mind. And now it all makes sense, right? Because, my issue was I was having flashes, right? So flashes of traumatic experiences, that's what I was having. And I can walk past somewhere and then, I'll have a flash of something bad that happened there. And, or I can be doing something, then I have a flash of something bad that happened there. And I can be moving somewhere, or I can smell something, and I can have a flash of something unpleasant that happened there, something that traumatized me in one way or another. Right. And then also I would have, images. It's like a picture. It's like a video that little, like, there's a difference between a flash, because a flash is an experience that you've had, right? A flash that is an experience that you've had before. So it's like reliving an old memory. Now with images, right? With images, it's more of a part where your brain is saying that, this is most probably how you're feeling, and your brain is sending you a signal of what it looks like in terms of what you need to do, like an outlet. So what I was having is violent. And I'm not violent, guys. I'm not violent. So I was having violent flashes, violent images, or violent images of something. So part of the violent images that I had was, when somebody's talking or when something is happening and it's annoying and frustrating me, I would have a flash of me going to the room and then I scream into the pillow, right? And it's just, I'm still sitting here. I'm still interacting with you, but that is where my mind takes me. So my mind is like, into the pillow, and then I come back and then I sit. Or I would have images of me, or videos per se, like it's visuals. Yes, let's say visuals of me just going into the middle of nowhere with a baseball bat, and I'm beating the living hell out of an object. I'm beating the living hell out of an old car, or I'm beating the living hell out of a building, or just violence, right? And I thought that was very uncommon for me, because I'm not a violent person. I believe in talking. I believe in sitting down and communicating. I believe in you tell me your issues and I'll tell you my issues. And then when we talk about it, you know, we'll resolve it. But then sometimes, right, issues are not resolved in an amicable manner, and issues are not resolved in the way that you would like it. And I think that is where my frustrations, my anger and my resentment came from, especially towards some individuals. So that is what I was going through. And I was like, yeah, but I don't like this. So what if one day I have a flash of harming a human? What if one day I have a flash of harming myself, you know? Because it is alarming when your brain starts doing things and it is basically telling you that, hey, I'm not coping. I'm not doing well. And I need you to help me, and I need you to assist me. So that's what my brain was doing. That's what my psyche was doing. And I felt that, you know. And then also the anxiety was also a lot. And then also the pressure. I had this immense sense of pressure, to do well. And also I had this fatigue, you know. I'm exhausted. I've been exhausted for like, I think it's been 2 months or so. I've been so exhausted and so drained and so put out. Like I'm just done, you know, and I'm thinking that no, this might be a burnout. This might be overwhelmed or year end fatigue. I'm looking at everything in the psychology books. I'm looking at everything in the psychology books except for major depressive disorder. I'm not looking at that because, and this is now a stereotype, or this is like, yeah, it's a stereotype, because I also, just like you, right? I pictured depression to look different. And since I've experienced it, I pictured depression to look like depression, you know, like you're sad and you're not feeling well and you have lost interest in the things that you like. And I'm like, okay, but the things that I like is work, and that's what keeps me going. So how am I demotivated when it comes to work? Because I'm showing up and I'm doing my thing, and I'm good, you know, and I'm happy, you know. We have conversations 3 hours, you know, having conversations with the Tebuana. We're having conversations with hush country. We're having conversations with Tatekwedi. We're having conversations with the kids. We're having conversations with Francina. We're having conversations. So how is it that I'm not motivated? I don't get it, because I mean, like, we're talking depression here. Like, what's up? I don't get it. Like, like, not me. And the irony behind it is that I am chief kingpin of all matriarchs, Don Matriarch. I am Don Matriarch when it comes to saying that, no, everything is not the same, guys. You, we are all different. And it's funny how my advice is now coming to bite me in the bum, because I'm supposed to apply the same principles as I'm dishing out. I'm supposed to, you know, I'm supposed to be listening to myself as well. And I was now in the hypocrisy of it can't be me because I'm not like this. How? So I was thinking OCD, right? I was thinking obsessive compulsive disorder. Because the flashes, right? The flashes, that those are symptoms, and, you know, easily triggered. Those are symptoms. And also wanting things to be done in a specific way and not getting it. And then when it is not done in that specific way, it riles me up. But then, right, the perfectionism in me also is the one that is also saying, but it's supposed to be like this. And then I'm like, yeah, but we can't make people do anything. We can't turn situations around. The only thing that we have control over to some degree is ourselves, right? So I'm trying to counsel myself, and I'm trying to see myself through these difficult times. So I've started counting the days. I'm like, yo, so I'm going to be out of here, going to rest for a couple of weeks, and I'm going to come back bigger and better. I'm going to come back with more to say, and I'm going to come out with fresh ideas, and I'm going to come back with greatness, right? And I'm thinking that it is just, I am just drained, and I'm just in this situation. And I'm like, it's not a big deal. It's not bad, you know? I don't have suicidal ideation. I don't have difficulty concentrating. Like, I don't have, you know, feelings of worthlessness. But those are all signs that are there. But it doesn't mean that those are the only signs. They're signs of fatigue. Yeah. Fatigue or insomnia. Now, I'm a girl that knocks off at 12 in the evening. I sleep some afternoons, right? But I also have a day job. So when do I sleep? I should be in bed by 12:30 at least, to wake up in the morning to be functioning. But no, Mughal is up until 4 a.m. doing what? Absolutely nothing. I look at the stars. I look at the ceilings. I look at the fairy lights. I decide that I'm going to clean the house now. And I decide that I'm mopping, but I'm mopping with a deep, deep sense of pine gel and jig so that the house smells spotless, because I don't like smells. All of a sudden, right? Because I'm not really iffy about smells and stuff like that, but all of a sudden now I've developed this need to tidy up. I'm not the neatest of people, and that's how I knew in my heart that there's something wrong with me. Why am I cleaning? Why am I making my bed every day? What's wrong with me? Sometimes there are things that look positive, like cleaning, for example, right? These are things that look positive, especially if you've been a messy person. I'm a very disorganized somebody in terms of like my space. I'm very books everywhere, papers everywhere, and then stuff everywhere. I just don't like clothes, and I don't like food that's everywhere, but everything else I can tolerate, you know? And then all of a sudden I can't tolerate that. And I'm like, but this paper, it has to move. Like, oh, let me fold. But this is 1 a.m. And then when I look at the time, I'm like, let me listen to an audiobook. This is nice. Okay, listen to an audiobook. What am I going to be doing? I'm going to be washing the windows. Oh, this is nice. Okay, cool. I'm going to be scraping all the parts. This is nice. And that's me, right? And that's me for the past 2 months. I'm cleaning. And yeah, like, everybody's like, oh, okay. Hey, mom. I'm like, hey guys, what time did you sleep? I'm going to sleep just now. And it doesn't look wrong, right? But it does send an alarming image to people that do know you. Because why are you washing everybody's laundry at night? Oh, what were you doing in the day? Whole night I'm doing laundry. I'm washing blankets. I'm washing towels. I'm washing clothes. And I'm hanging them outside and I'm waiting for them to dry. You know what? I'm going to iron. And then I iron. And in all of this, I think that there's absolutely nothing wrong with me. I feel like I'm just having an ordinary time. I just got this new burst of energy that I'm going to utilize for good. And it's good. It's great, right? I make the baby's food, put it in lunch boxes, you know. I already pre-cook lunch for tomorrow. I'm like, I'm busy in that flat, guys. I'm very busy in that flat. All right, we missed out on that one. The number in studio is 083-288-401. So I'm very busy in my household, right? And this is an alarm. This is an alarm that's going off. My body's like ding, 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 ding. One, we are about our sleep and we are about our rest because we understand sleep hygiene. We understand good sleeping habits. We understand that. So why are we developing bad sleeping habits all of a sudden? That's the first alarm. Second alarm is you are overly active. And I'm not saying just clean because a lot of people associate OCD to cleanliness. And it's not the case. That's such a bad myth, stereotype. It's so bad because even when somebody that has another kind of OCD comes along, you won't be able to recognize it because you assumed and associated OCD with the person that is a germaphobe, somebody that hates germs, somebody that's afraid to contract something from germs, right? We associate it to that. So Mughal is cleaning. Mughal is all over the place. I think I even cleaned the TV, like, and the couches, and I'm humming songs, and I don't even want to listen to music because also what has happened recently is that every time I listen to music, that is the earworm that I'm going to be having for the next couple of days. So, in my head, there is Brenda Storm, and it's just, you broke me gently, but I survived, picked up my pieces, brought back to life. You broke me gently, but I survived, picked up my pieces. Hey. Okay, so it happens twice. You're like, okay, cool. And then, after 5 seconds, you broke me gently, but I survived, picked up my pieces. You broke me gently, but I survived, picked up my piece. How? Now imagine that happening for 2 hours. How, guys? Loony bin. My friend. So I just stopped listening to music so that I would forget, so that my mind would forget. And then I don't want to associate to music because then I have an earworm. And an earworm is only nice because it's only nice when you have an earworm and you can get rid of it. But now, for me, the earworm was consistent. So the earworm is there. And then I play the song, right? And I play the song. And then I'm like, okay, baby, my spirit, right, wants to hear it until it's full. So I put it on repeat. Okay? I put it on repeat and I'm washing the rug, right? Because this is absolutely ordinary. This is absolutely normal to do at 2 a.m. I'm washing the rug. I'm playing music. I'm on that. I learned the words. We're doing this. I'm swerving and I'm tossing and turning in a house. I almost said, tossing and turning in a bed that don't belong to me. He said, what do you mean? She said, just wait and see. Robert. And I'm doing this, and it's been an hour, and I'm done, and I'm thinking, okay, cool, so we can switch it off. And then I switch it off, and then, you broke me gently, but I survived, picked up my pieces. How? So the earworm is not going away, because the earworm is supposed to go away when you listen to the song. When you listen to the song, and your heart is content with the song. So I'm thinking, okay. So I'm just listing down a few things that I think is wrong with me. And I'm listening, right? Because, okay, so OCD, we have established that, yeah. Maybe, yeah, there's something there. Self-aware, right? This is not Elizabeth. I don't know you like this girl. This is not. And then I move on. Okay, so we research now and we jump into our psychology books and we're like, okay, cool. All right. Okay. Okay, cool. Yeah. Karl Marx. Young. Okay. Plato. Machiavelli. Okay, cool. The philosophers and the psychologists and psychiatrists have come through and we understand and we have self-diagnosed, which are, there might be, yeah, there might be a little OCD there, but we're not doctors. So we say there might be, yeah. Because we need to identify that there's something wrong with us. Now, what makes something wrong with us? The fact that we're cleaning, the fact that we have earworms, the fact that we're having flashes, the fact that we're having images and visuals. All right. Cool. Then we have the complex trauma. The complex trauma is the fear that you get whenever you have to relive a very scary moment. Now, you don't have to relive nothing. Right? Because that moment has passed. But something similar to you, similar to that situation, sends you right back to the actual trauma. Then that started happening. So every time I get into a car, I'm like, yeah. So it's kind of a nightmare getting to work, right? Because, hey, so I start walking everywhere. I'm joking. Can't walk to work, but if I could, I would. So, and little things, you know, little traumas that I didn't even think were very traumatic. Then I started getting angry, not hungry, but angry. So I would have aggressive demeanor, you know, I would have aggressive demeanor. But then on top of the aggressive demeanor, I was extremely angry. But then my anger was not warranted. It wasn't an anger that was justified. You know, we could be talking about a flower and we disagree and you are wrong and I would absolutely get outraged. Now, this outrage of mine is basically the feeling that I get. So now we have established that I'm not a violent person. So it's the feeling that I have, like that uncomfortable feeling of anger, like, and it's last number kind of anger. And that was the one that was alarming me because I live with children, you know, and I don't want to get angry at children. It's like, hey, I live with people. I don't want to get angry with people. And also my migraines and my headaches were not going away. And also my ears became extremely sensitive to sound. And it was just the sounds were way too many. The sounds were way too many and I can't, like, it's the TV that's playing. It's the children that are screaming. It's the man that's talking. It's the phone that's ringing. It's the text that's coming in. It's my own annoyances and it became a lot. But I would be extremely agitated and extremely irritable, right? And for me, it was the man that was getting the biggest outlash, right? The lash out, because he's the closest, he's in close proximity. The children are in close proximity, but there is a sense of drawing the line when it comes to children, because you can't just be shouting at children and you can't just, you know, like, whoa, like, no, you can't do that. But now everything that he says is annoying. Everything that, like, I think also with built up resentment and built up, like, you know, so everything, like, I would say, a lot. I would roll my eyes and I'm just mean. And I would say my tone and my demeanor is extremely aggressive. You understand? So yeah. And then I started having nightmares and night terrors and then also rapid sweating during the night. And I'm talking about the last 2 months, right? Just before Monday. I'm talking about my life here. I'm talking about what's happening. But never, Never at all did I think it was depression. How could it be? I'm very active, you know? And I also know about functioning depression. Like, you can be a functioning depressed person. And I thought, like, okay, cool. But things would be going wrong, right? And then things did start going wrong. And that's when I knew, like, ah, yeah. I get it. So I went to the hospital. And I encourage you guys, like, if you would rather, right, lose your mind and become a crazy person that's picking up Ndohas, be my guest. If that's what you want to do, it's your life, be my guest. But if you are a person that wants to give yourself a fair fighting chance, a fair chance at life, a fair chance to be okay, right? And you feel like there's something wrong, then I would suggest, let's go, guys. Like, hey, the hospital is free. Eh? They're psychiatric. You don't even pay for kakarata. Because, whoa, how can they make you pay? You're having emotional distress. You're having a crisis, a mental crisis, guys. So they won't, like, they are like, yes, let's come on in. Come on in. Let's do this. There's a doctor. There's a psychologist. There's a psychiatrist. All three at your disposal for absolutely nothing. While you guys are exhausting and depleting your medical aids because you guys are so afraid of who's going to find you there. And then you go there. And then there's no problem with going private. There's absolutely no problem with going private. But can you afford it? Yeah, that's the question. Can you afford private? If you can afford private, by all means, go private. And it's okay. Now, you guys might be thinking, like, oh, we stained. They don't really give you guys enough time because there's a lot of patients. Like, that's on the contrary. That's absolutely wrong because they give you an hour and 30 minutes with a psychologist. They give you an hour and 30 minutes with a psychiatrist. They give you at least 30 minutes with the general doctor. So, there's no excuse. If you are feeling, right, like, I don't think that I'm okay in any way, guys, because these suicides are ridiculous. These suicides are ridiculous, especially when we have assistance. We have assistance and it's there. I'm speaking as an advocate for mental well-being. I'm all for mental well-being. I'm all for it. Do you know that many of you guys are walking around with undiagnosed mental disorders? Undiagnosed. And you guys think it's permanent. You guys think it's temporary. I don't know what you guys are thinking. But as for me, you know, I'm going to fight for myself. I'm fighting for my job. I'm fighting for my children. I'm fighting for my business. I'm fighting for my family. I'm fighting for my friends to still have a friend. I'm fighting for my colleagues to still have a colleague. I'm fighting for my audience to still have a host. I'm fighting for my people to still have a matriarch. And the only way I can fight is if I take care of this element. Right? And it's by identifying things that are not me. Now, you might be thinking overnight that you just became an automatically clean person and you just love cleaning now. I don't know what happened to me. And you are enjoying that. But I know myself. I've been with myself for 34 years. I know myself. I am not a neat person. I clean according to circumstances. I clean according to my schedule. Do I have other things to do? If I don't have anything else to do, then I'll clean. But I will not clean while I have other things to do. And that is why also I decided that I don't want to pick up because I'm a knitter, right? Or handi knitting, like I knit. So I knit scarves and beanies and cardigans and stuff like that. Cause I did home economics as a child. I did home economics and we learned how to knit. We learned patterns. We learned everything. Thank you so much. Thank you so much, Parkis, for our home economics class. Because we learned how to cook. We learned how to knit. We learned how to sew. We learned woman stuff. Thank you. So what I've noticed and what I have realized about myself is that every time the soup gets hot, every time my life becomes unmanageable in one way or another, or I feel like it's unmanageable in one way or another, I start passion projects. Ha! My mom used to call me Ramatex. One should have known. My mom used to call me Ramatex because there's nothing I cannot. Eh? Oti kuhonjere, oti kuhonjero hema, eh? Odede. With, I will sew. I sew, I braid, I do all handy stuff. But I now realize that I learned these skills as coping mechanisms to avoid my life, to avoid the stresses of my life. Right? So recently I've been having an urge to start crocheting or to start knitting. Now I'm doing everything in my power to not start. I'm going to start, right? But I'm going to start in the holiday, when I'm on holiday, when I'm not working, because I don't want to be missing work because I'm at home knitting. Yeah, I'm just knitting this scarf for HD, guys. I cannot leave this stitch. And that's me. And that's why my mom used to call me Ramatex, because every time the exams come along, I find a passion project. I start knitting. Instead of studying, I start knitting. Instead of studying, I start sewing clothes. Instead of knitting, instead of reading, I start making blankets. Do you know these quilts? It's the nama dress. The nama dress has many patches, right? So I think like when I was in grade nine, or I don't think it was high school, but somewhere there along the years, right? I made a quilt straight up. I made a quilt and I put material together and I made it was straight and I hand stitched it while other kids were studying. And I think it was just because of the pressure that I had, because I can only take in so much and then I overflow, like I explode. So as an outlet, I decided that I'm going to divert my attention. I'm going to put it somewhere else. So I made a quilt. A whole quilt that you can put in a single. It's a three-quarter duvet. Yeah, I made a quilt for myself with a zip and everything. And imagine I was a kid. I think I was like, what? It can't be high school. It wasn't high school. I think it was grade 7 or grade 6. I made a quilt. You know, I made myself a whole duvet cover to put in. And I was so bummed when it was done. Because now it was finished. And then I realized like, but it needs a pillowcase. And then my material was finished. My mother was not, she's not about that. She's like, ah, no girl, you cannot just be a sewer. You cannot just be a knitter. Who tailor? Ah, Ramatex. My mom used to call me Ramatex. You remember Ramatex? Yeah, my mother used to call me Ramatex because that is what I used to do. And now I find myself at 34. This is a habit that I had in primary school, right? And now at 34, I find myself having an urge to escape my reality, my life, and start knitting and start crocheting and start sewing and that. And I know that that's bad because I can watch the whole world crumble around me and I can only be concerned about stitching. Like imagine that. I can literally like, oh, I have to start over. Like, are we making a duck? Like the whole world can be burning up behind me. And I'm like, I think I missed a stitch here. So I have to take it out and then I have to start over. Like, oh, this is such a nice color. I love this wool. I can watch the whole world around me crumble while I'm knitting a scarf. And the problem is that when the scarf is done, I start another one. And another one. Can I make a jersey? And then now I have all these wool products, right? And I just keep going and keep going and keep going until I have a mental breakdown. So that's what I've been trying to avoid because I've had the urge. Like even like lately, all I want to do is wear wool. So wool might for me represent something. It might represent a time in my life where I felt safest and where I felt where I felt safe, where I felt like I had things together. So right now I'm in my era of wearing my wool cardigans and my wool jerseys. And I'm in full swing out here and in my honest and authentic self. I'm here to tell my story without omissions, without cut, without making it seem pretty. I'm basically having a very tough time. I've been having a very tough time and I've been struggling. You know, I've been mentally struggling and I haven't been coping very well. A lot has been happening. And like I said, I never thought it was depression. I didn't. I really thought it was everything else. I even at some point thought like maybe we can also test for bipolar. We went for the test. It's not there. I'm like, oh, okay. Oh. I've never been fully disappointed that I don't have something. I was like, oh, okay. Then what is it? You know, because I'm not okay. I don't feel okay. I'm not okay. So what is it then? You know, but like I said, I never ever jumped to depression ever, because depression doesn't look like that. And especially for me that has had it for a long time, right? Throughout my life, I thought I knew it, but I didn't know what depression looked like at 34. And that's the beauty of finding out, because now I'm like, yeah, guys, hi guys out there that are listening. Like it looks different. Okay. It looks different with the different stages of things you take up and things you let behind and your age and your situation and your children. It looks so different. And I understand why it looks different, because as a mom, right? Can't actually afford to be depressed. I can't. It's like, 50 Cent said that, was it 50? Yeah, 50 said that depression is a rich person's disease, right? Many of us are just walking around depressed, but we can't actually stop going, because what happens if we stop? What happens if we stop is that everything around us crumbles. Those that depend on us crumble. And that's what I was asking. I was talking about it with the psychologist, right? And I was talking about it like, but I said like, oh, so is it that I'm a functioning depressed person or what is it? It's like, no, it's not that you're actually functioning, because if you were functioning, you wouldn't even notice that you're depressed, and you wouldn't be depressed because you find fulfillment in it. It's not that you're functioning. You're not functioning. You're just living up to your responsibilities. I'm like, bam. Bra, gazam, the what? Shoo, hello, I hear you. I was like, makes a whole lot of sense, sis. It makes a whole lot of sense, because, I mean, here I am. I'm like, yeah, but I was expecting to be covering myself, you know, in a blanket. I'm not going to go to work today because I'm so, I don't feel nice. Like, I'm sad, you know, and ignore phones and ignore what? And and that's not the case. I'm here. That's not the case, right? So I'm like, yeah. So what is it? And she's like, no, it's depression. So I'm depressed, guys. Yep. The matriarch. A whole dongahan. I am. I'm depressed. And I own it. I own it because I love the fact that I understand what's happening to me. I understand. I like knowing what is wrong so that I can fix it. Because this thing of going around not knowing what is wrong with you. Now you can't even explain why you're always angry. And it's not like I'm always angry. I just have like, I have little sparkles. And these little sparkles kind of look like fireworks now and then, but only for those in the crossfires. And I'm like, yay, but I don't want to be this girl. I don't want to be this girl. I don't want to be like this. So what's up? So let me figure myself out. And there are things that I didn't mind, right? Like, for example, when I'm telling you guys about the cleaning, you would be like, an ordinary person, including myself, would be like, but that's a good thing to pick up, right? Because now your house is spotless. Yeah. You must do it when you're fine. not when you're not fine. It becomes something else. It becomes a new disease that you're looking for like that. What's that?
E filoshisho otalikula ndulako na vewa yuka. E kwashilipalekolo maruendo paiwano kupitila mo NHB. O atupa teleko meshe kwashilipalekolo afika mafio pedola emiliona omlongo danamibia. Moshi joshe tukeshe kuyanja omakwafo unamiti enashane filoshisho lopa ulumo mumbu. Kwa voveli ponjeo shilongo, shijoshi topo rwasho ijo yetu, tashiningwa inapawe banando ishoshe layash. Opo umone ya kulolo polis mwule omenute dishona elela, lishangifako nhp.com.na omanga ino ya moruendo ponjeo shilongo. E mangono malandula fano, odo dino kulandurwa. NHP, rooted in care for you.
Your health, your life, your peace of mind. NHP, we're about you.
NHP, we're about you. Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome to Pulling Heartstrings, where we are addressing the elephant in the room. And on the dissecting table tonight is yours truly, the matriarch. We're talking about her situation. We're talking about me, eh? Third voice, like the way we are talking about her, like it's a person that is far away. We're talking about my recent diagnosis of MDD. That's major depressive disorder. So I was diagnosed on Monday, and I'm just talking about my journey. I'm talking about how I got here, Pris. I'm talking about how I got here and how I didn't see it coming. I didn't see it coming, and I didn't think that I've never in my whole entire life ever thought that something is above me, something is beneath me. I've never thought that I can't get something. Like never. I've never been one of those girls or one of those people that says that, oh no, that could never be me. I could never go crazy, or I could never have diabetes, or I could never have cancer. No, I'm not one of those. I always assume the worst for myself as well. If it can happen to somebody else, it can happen to me as well. I'm no special. We are just here. We're having a human experience, and maybe my human experience is being poked by a porcupine. It is what it is. That's me. That's how I visualize. So for me, what was a little shocker there for me is that I didn't think that was my problem. I didn't think that. I really honestly didn't think that, because I thought that maybe, right? It's other things. Maybe it's something other than depression. Depression didn't even come to my mind. No, it didn't come to my mind. It wasn't a thought. It wasn't even an afterthought. I'm like, no. I didn't think it. And I always thought that I just want to be curled up in the room. I just want to be alone. But I thought that even the times where some of the symptoms were there, I assumed it was because I was tired. So I wanted to be alone, but it was because I thought I was tired, right? Because I'm so exhausted. I never thought that my exhaustion is actually fatigue. No, I didn't think that. So this is me sharing a conversation with you so that, right, you, beloved, can get yourself checked out. Go to the hospital, bruh. It is basically empty right now because everybody has left and everybody has already gotten their medication. So you get there and then you just tell them that, yeah, hello, I was listening to the Matriarch's show, and then she said that I must come. She said that I must come here if I need mental assistance. Because you guys are having like a whole like thing. Like you guys are for us, you know, for our mental well-being. And then if it's nighttime, you must go to the emergency room, which is at Katutura Hospital. And you get a card, you go inside, right? And when you go inside, you tell them that you need to see a psychologist and it is an emergency of some sort. Or it is an emergency. You're having a breakdown or you're having a crisis, so you don't know what's happening to you. And they will get the doctor on call, and the doctor will come to you straight up. Okay? straight. And then also, if it is very, very severe, you can call the ambulance to pick you up, and then the ambulance can take you. And then in that case, you don't really sit in the queues and all of that. You get taken in immediately, and it will, like, the mental health crisis is real. And like, having doubt them, they are working at their ministry. They are working. So yeah. So I went inside and I put up all my symptoms. And one of the questions that was asked is, do you ever wake up in the morning and you're like, oh, I'm like, yeah, every day. But it's not like I'm unhappy that I'm awake and I'm alive. It's more like, oh, I'm tired. Like, but how can you go to bed, go and rest, and then you wake up tired? Like, that's not a good sign, Moss. So, and also, like, you don't want to get out of bed and you don't want to do anything. It's like, yes, I do, but I don't do it. So I thought that because I feel like it, but I don't do it, I'm fine. Ha. Can't you know? Just the feeling alone. Nah, that's bad. If you feel it, yeah. Even if you go and do it, you know why you're doing it. You're doing it for the children. You're doing it for the employees. You're doing it for your colleagues. You're doing it for the company that you work for. You're doing it for yourself. You know why you're doing it. And just because you have a lot of willpower doesn't mean that you don't feel bad. Doesn't mean that you're not in a bad space. Doesn't mean that you are not struggling. You're struggling. You're struggling. So, major depressive disorder, MDD, symptoms include persistent sadness or emptiness. Now, the sadness was like, the sadness was the there, right? But I had a reason. So, every time I felt sad, I would look for a reason as to why I'm sad. So, sometimes, some days, right, I would have reasons like, I'm so sad because I'm tired, but the sadness doesn't match the tired that I'm talking about. I would make excuses for why I feel the way I feel. So I would say, I'm sad because I'm tired. Yeah. And then it's like, I'm sad. Why? Because people in the world are dying. Like, why is it always there? Yeah, but I'm a humanitarian at heart. Like, okay, ma'am. Okay. And then the emptiness. It's like this hollow space. It's like this hollow space in your heart where you don't really experience emotions like fully, like even joy, right? It seems like it just tickles. It's like a tip of the iceberg and then that's it. Like, you continue smiling, you continue talking. And for me, it's a bit difficult to see that I'm not really happy. It's difficult because I'm naturally, like, I've got a good aura. If I must say so myself. Yeah. I'm a naturally laughy person. I'm a naturally loud person, like funny person. I'm a comedian, guys. Please. Like, don't get it twisted. I'm a comedian. It's my job to make you laugh. So, I carry my job very serious. So, when I go out there, it's very difficult for you to see. It's very difficult for you to see that I'm not well. Not unless I've hit major league rock bottom, but on what an ordinary day, I don't really look rock bottomy. Like, nah, no. Not always. I don't look rock bottomy all the time. Sometimes I do, and sometimes I don't. For the most part, I do because I spend a lot of time at home. I call myself a homebody. But that's just the depression. Anyhow, so you can't really feel. So you can't really see. But there's this emptiness, right? There's this emptiness that's there. It's like, And then there's a loss of interest in activities. Loss of interest in activities for me is loss of interest in activities. So I'm a person that liked to write. I liked to sing. I liked music. I liked making people happy. I liked so many things. And now all of a sudden, I don't like anything. I like work. You know, I like work. That's it. So I don't have interests that spark me. You know, I don't want to go outside. There's nothing to do. If I didn't have a job at Eagle FM, I'd never leave the house. Like literally, Eagle FM is the only reason that I still have a sense of social interactions with others. Like honestly, because I stay at home. So maybe it's that loss of interest in activities. Yeah. I don't want to go. I don't want to do nothing. Like, I don't want to go-karting. I don't want to. There's only one thing I want to do is, and it's go kumafuta. But apart from that, there's nothing. I don't. Yeah. But right now I have most now an interest, right? I have this interest of knitting. Yeah. I have this interest of knitting and crocheting. But then that also, that's not a real activity that I can pinpoint. That is an activity that I used to use as a child to escape traumatic experiences, to escape reality. I used to drown myself in those. So I don't know if it's a real interest in an activity or it's just a coping mechanism or an escape mechanism, right? And then the fatigue, always tired, sleepy. Ah, bad. And then there's appetite changes, loss of appetite. Now, when we talk of loss of appetite, right? Most people don't really have a problem with that loss of appetite because, I don't know, all of us body goals apparently is just to be thin. So we're like, I'm losing weight. And you get happy. I'm losing weight. But yeah, I don't see it, but I do have like poor appetite. And then feelings of worthlessness. That one, no. I don't feel worthless. I feel very worthy. I feel very worthy. But then the feelings of guilt. So there are certain feelings of guilt that I do have, like of choices that I've made that I feel are detrimental, especially to the children, especially with my battles that I'm having currently. Part of the battles is that, there's a whole maintenance court. There's a whole maintenance court thing that we are doing now with my son's father. And there's an element of guilt of like, yeah, bam, man. Like, children are supposed to grow up in happy homes, you know. Like, you know, I feel bad for him. And then also part of the guilt that I'm feeling as a mom, and especially with my own issues, I thought that maybe the anxiety that I've had as a child or the anxiety that I've had as an individual and the depression that I've had as an individual along the years might be something that is genetic. I know better. I do know better. Right? But tell that to my mind. My heart knows better. My mind knows better, but there's a little piece inside of me that's screaming, assist me, help me. That element of guilt of, because my son was diagnosed with anxiety disorder and he's now on medication and I feel extremely guilty, for many things. I feel extremely guilty for not giving him the life that he deserves. You know, he deserves the sun and the moon and the stars and, you know, that feeling inadequate. And maybe I'm thinking like, oh, am I messing my kid up, you know? And like, oh, now I look at him and I feel so bad for him. But he's great. Like in all honesty, I'm the problem. He's great. He's on that. Thank you so much for helping me, mommy. All good. Sharp. And he's not even like worried about me or nothing like that. He's not calling me 10 times. He's not. He is living his life. And I'm the one that is, you know, I'm stuck in these little guilts, you know. And then also, there are also little guilts, like in terms of like things that are not settled and, it's just wild. And then, difficulty concentrating. Not me. I concentrate. I fully concentrate. And then, and thoughts of death and suicide. So now this one is a tough one, right? Because I think I had suicidal ideation at some point, but then that was eliminated. And again, it's eliminated by my motivators. My motivators are my family. I can't leave those poor children out here that didn't ask to be here. I can't. I can't bring it to myself. So there are certain times where I had thought, right, I've thought of jumping, right? Because we live in the fourth story. I thought of jumping. But then that one was quickly eliminated because it doesn't serve. It doesn't serve me. So I don't have suicidal ideation any longer. And then I have physical aches. Yeah. And I have physical aches and pains all over my body. Now I was thinking like, yeah, but why am I, you know, and this was one of those, that I didn't think of, because usually, you have physical aches and pains in your body, like, oh, you know, spasming and your body is tense and your body is what? And I was like, oh, but why do I feel like this? I'm meant to be tired, or like maybe I laid down a lot, or what's wrong? So I never thought of it. And then here it is. And then I now remember that, for the past like 3 weeks or so, I was getting a massage every day because my body it wasn't coping. It was so tense. It was tension upon tension upon tension when it came to my body. So those are the signs and symptoms. And then the irritability, very highly irritated. And the mood or lack of pleasure. So nothing was giving me pleasure, like at all. So even you there that's thinking at all, really at all. I'm like, yes, at all. Nothing was giving me pleasure at all. Like there's nothing that was giving me pleasure. And that is how I knew. I knew that there's something seriously wrong with me. So I went to the hospital and I did my tests, you know. I saw a psychiatrist, and then I saw a general practitioner, and then I saw a psychologist. So I had a full day of activities on Monday, and it was all at Central Hospital there at psychiatric. And the diagnosis came up and we dealt with it. Like, so yeah. So the girl is officially now on medication. So I'm going to be on medication for a while, but I am feeling much better. So I'm on fluoxetine, and fluoxetine is like a magic. Like it's a magic. You know, I took two of them because I needed first aid. I took two of them because I needed first aid, and it was like, just like my mind was being held, and then it just, like it was like just lifted, and I feel so much better, and I feel so relieved because now I'm fighting, right? Now I'm fighting a battle, and I have the correct equipment to fight it. So if you would like to comment, if you would like to add, if you would like to participate, if you would like to talk about your experience as well, the number in studio is 083-288-401. That is the number in studio.
The views and opinions expressed by our guests and callers are not those of Eagle FM and Innovate staff.
My friend, why do you seem so worried?
Ace, I am planning an event for next weekend, and I don't know how to best get people to hear about it.
Saima, don't worry about those small things. Contact Eagle FM today. Eagle FM has a dedicated team that can travel anywhere countrywide to broadcast live at any event, such as a promotion, organizational launch, anniversary, wedding, funeral, political or traditional and church events, and basically any event that you wish to broadcast on a national level. Call them now and talk to Monica at 081-270-3727 or the office number 083-288-400. Eagle FM, the eye.
mvura nengeno wapumbwa eva tero ulikoni maondo tuto ingida ashike kapeno nweku tete opoye ekukurile oshafafana nongeshe faili mehola mo ihewe tike kovano ile koshuwana onongeshe faa ya pumbwa kukaraya kovano okupitira mo Eagle FM otuna evi toda njuka okukwetira oipindi konu konda doili nawa nune udo otukwetira o special ange tashake ngeshe faa omarudi dayo loka opone ushendife nawa nokumona oijamoili nawa ninge kwata fanona monika ko Eagle FM onora etatu imwe bali heali nola natu heali bali no heali ile kumberewa vura hetatu natu bali o hetatu matatu o mafilane Eagle FM the eye
Eagle FM the eye. Good evening to you if you have just joined us. Today is Thursday and it is a lovely evening with the matriarch. So if you are listening on the app, hi. Hi. If you're listening on radio, hey. Hey. If you're listening, I don't know, from your grandfather's subwoofer, what's up? What's up? How you doing? So ladies and gentlemen, so now, our conversation for tonight is basically tough diagnosis, right? Being diagnosed with something that is either very stigmatized against or very detrimental or very dangerous or very unknown or complex or whatever we might, you know, wherever we might categorize it. Now, when it comes to mental disorders, when it comes to mental disorders, ladies and gentlemen, many of us stigmatize it. Yeah? Many of us don't understand it. Many of us also just want to run away from it. And many of us think that it is a death sentence. So for me, I don't know what kind of person I am, but I'm all for the doctor. I'm for the doctor. I'm for the nganga. I'm for the astrologist. I'm all for the people that are capable. I'm for the church as well. I'm all for the people that are capable of assisting another human being. So I'm not picking the pastor over the psychiatrist. I'm not picking the general practitioner over the nurse. I'm not. I'm choosing all of you guys. Like if a collective can come and assist me, like the more the merrier. Let everybody put all their knowledge here to assist me. Do you know why? Because I want to live. I want to live. I want to live. I want to live. I have so much I still have to do and an impact that I must put outside there, right? So I don't want to go out like that. And you know, right? You know how dangerous it is to be having hopeless emotions and worthless emotions and feeling like nobody loves you and feeling like this is just empty and feeling no joy and feeling sadness. Do you know what that does? That pushes people to feel, right? Suicidal. That pushes people to want to end their lives. That pushes people to think and feel like nobody cares about them, right? And we don't want to be in that. We don't want to be in that. That's why me, I talk. My dear, even if it was HIV that I was diagnosed with, ne? And when they support someone. Like, because I believe, right, that there's nothing embarrassing. There's nothing embarrassing because of what I do and who I represent. I represent a matriarch. That is who I am. I am a matriarch. I am a queen mother of the tribe. If I am the tribe leader that is leading you, then I must lead by example. I must talk. I must talk my issues. I must talk my situation in order for you guys, right, to understand. In order for you guys to follow in my footsteps. So now, Vele, if me, I'm hiding my issues, how are you going to go and seek for a assistance if your mom is not telling you, kucha, hey, for depression, I'm paying nanga and then tapo kana kanje, and then tapo, and then duvitengeika, nani oshimo shiringeika, and then tatutana ukire kumbinganji, they pay for turimpano, mara pay for ndirike pango. No, like you wouldn't, because I appear to be perfect. Do you know that out of all three people that I've told, when they came to see me, everybody said, but you look fine. I'm like, of course. Even you guys are listening like, yeah, but you sound fine. Of course. And this is why I say it is so dangerous, because all of you guys say things like, yeah, the people that are the happiest the most are the ones that commit suicide. They are the ones that are the happiest the most are the ones that are depressed. Like, but maybe I'm not happy. This is just my personality, kid. Maybe I'm just like this. Maybe it's just my personality. Maybe I'm not moping around because this is absolutely important to me. Maybe that's it. Maybe it's not like, oh my goodness, you're just so happy. Like, I can't believe it. She was just smiling with us yesterday. I'm allowed to smile if a joke is funny, bro. You are allowed to laugh if the joke is funny. Doesn't mean that if you're depressed, right, you can't laugh now and then. You can't feel happy now and then. It's just that you have a serious illness. That's it. You just have a serious illness. Even people that have cancer laugh. Even people that have tuberculosis laugh. Even people with HIV laugh. Even people that are at funerals laugh. So we are allowed to. We're allowed to have human experiences, Chomi. And we will have these human experiences. Do you know why we'll have them? Because we are happier now that we have assistance. I believe that we can only fight things we know. If you don't know what's wrong with you, you will never be actually able to fight it. So we are drinking our fluoxetine. We're drinking our fluoxetine, which is an antidepressive. It's an antidepressive that is also, it conquers so many things. Like if you are on fluoxetine out there in the world, right? Go and read that paper. You will see the benefits. I'm like, this is an expensive one. Because if you're buying it, it's expensive. But if you're getting it for free, and you're feeling like the matriarch, I'm telling you, don't deplete your medical aid. Especially if you have kids. Don't deplete your medical aid. Just go to state. Don't deplete your medical aid for nothing. Because a day will come where your children need an operation and you have depleted it because you don't want to be at psychiatric. Like I saw a man with okahanona. Like okahanona, brur. Kahanona is a kahanona. It's a small little baby. Like the babies that are not even a month yet. I saw him sitting outside with his person, you know, with his little baby. While the mom was inside and she was seeing the doctor and getting her medication because she had postnatal depression. And you could see, right, that this is somebody that is supportive. And best friend and I were sitting there and we were laughing and saying, Kucha, that man will not let you hold his baby. They've been through a lot together with that baby. You know, and for me, it's such a pleasure to see how many of you guys are actually taking it very seriously to take care of yourselves. Take care of yourselves, guys. Take care of yourselves so that your children can live to see the day where you are old on a stick. So that you don't leave your children here over issues that could have been resolved, over issues that could have been cured by a little pill. You know? And I'm living testimony and I'm living proof that it gets better, and it is getting better. So we are 4 days in to our meds, and they are helping me. I feel much better. It's just that we have to break the pills in because there's a little bit of a migraine that is happening, but it's so mild. But that just only lasts for at least 5 days. And then after the fifth day, then it's smooth sailing after that. And then I can't wait to be better. And even if I have to stay on it for life, I don't care. As long as I'm better. As long as I get to see my kids, and as long as I get to see my kids off to high school and university, as long as I can be a part of my kids' lives and I can be a healthy and contributing member of their lives, I don't care. I would rather be on a pango, to be with my children than to be pretending that I don't have a problem. I have a problem, you know? I have a problem. I'm not okay. And right now, this is my step to becoming okay. So we're going to find things that fulfill us. We're going to find things that make us happy. We're going to find things that we're going to fine tune the things that do make us, feel alive again and feel blessed to be here. And we're going to learn. We're going to learn. We're going to learn. We're going to learn. We're going to learn about. Ooh-la-la. Alrighty, you can call back, ladies and gentlemen. The number in studio is 083-288-401. I know I'm talking with my hands and stuff and I don't see the buzz, but it's okay. Please do call in. And for those that are doing holiday things already, please do take care of yourself. If you got like your blood pressure medication, if you got your ARVs and if you got your TB medication and stuff like that, please pick up your medication before you leave for holiday so that you don't get stranded in the village without your medication. Please. And then also, so we're going to be talking. So initially we're talking was now about diseases, serious ailments, right? And coping with depression, anxiety and serious ailments. How are we going to cope with it? How are we going to, you know, live with it? Because maybe, I think that I'm just extremely excited about the fact that I don't feel like I felt last week. I think I'm happy about that. And some other people cry. You know, I remember, I think it was like 5 years ago, I had depression again, right? And I remember standing in the pharmacy and crying, you know, like it was five. Maybe four, you know, I remember standing in the pharmacy and crying because I was so unhappy that I had it. And I was so like, oh no, oh no, 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 no. You know, I had to sit down, you know, and they had to give me a glass of water in the pharmacy because I'm like, oh no, you know, and 34 year old me, that's like 29 year old, 28 year old me. Now 34 year old me is like, yay. I have an aunt of mine, Mekito. Hey, I've never seen anybody that loves pills like my aunt loves pills. She loves medication so much. And she was diagnosed with HIV, I think, like a while back. And she didn't have full-blown AIDS yet. So she had to wait. She had to wait to start getting medication. I don't know what policy that was. So she had to wait until the HIV turned to AIDS. And she was so unhappy. Like, she was so unhappy. She was so unhappy about it that, I had to just go to the pharmacy and get some vitamins and stuff. And then I put it like in a nice container and I was like, okay, take these. These are also for your disease. So take these. And she was happy and she was drinking. So every time they finish, she was like, oh, pera danjo da papo. And then I'll get more vitamins and stuff. And then I was sad, you know, because she was very unhappy that she didn't, I don't know. She didn't qualify to start drinking ARVs yet. Like, so she was very unhappy about that. So I feel like I'm her right now. I feel very privileged and I feel very privileged at having an opportunity to not be as gloomy and as sick as I was. I feel very privileged to be getting assistance and to be getting help. Like, to be honest, like, that is not an emotion that you want to have. That is not a space that you want to be in. So I'm like, yay. Fluoxetine is doing the things. Hey. And fluoxetine does so many things. It's like a wonder drug. It does so many things. It cures what? It clears inflammation. It cures, like, it's like a multitasking tablet. It runs to all the areas that are not feeling well in your body. Like, wow. Fluey. So that's my ordeal. That's my experience. But let's see how Dr. Ramani talks about coping with depression, anxiety, and serious illnesses. Now, ladies and gentlemen, we as Eagle Media House do not claim any ownership of the clips that we are playing here on Pulling Heartstrings. This is strictly for educational purposes so that we can see experienced people's diagnoses and experienced people's experiences. All right? So don't go out there and tell Tata Wakucha, yeah, but you guys said that that is your thing. Like, no, no. I give you a disclaimer. Danny got a disclaimer, eh? So, okay, let's dive into it, ladies and gentlemen. I love you plenty.
We just hit 1 million subscribers on YouTube. And to say thank you, we're releasing this series in its entirety on YouTube so that you, your family, and friends
on them. So it really is. It's life altering. And these medical illnesses don't necessarily mean someone's going to die, though many people who get these diagnoses dementia to a whole host of autoimmune conditions like lupus. But these are illnesses that once you have this diagnosis, this is going to put into motion the need for the person who's been diagnosed with the illness to get very involved with medical treatment. And often there can be intensive acute medical treatment that follows. And then months or even years of follow-up treatment. So not only does the person's course of their life can often change from months or years in the face of that diagnosis, so too can the lives of the people around them. So it really is, it's life-altering. And these medical illnesses don't necessarily mean someone's going to die, though many people who get these diagnoses find themselves immediately thinking about their own mortality, because in many cases, having one of these illnesses can shorten lifespan. For example, we know many people who have been diagnosed with cancer successfully go through a course of treatment, are in remission, and are living very, very full lives. But at the time of the acute crisis, it is life-altering. And for the rest of a person's life, they will say, this is something I have to monitor, a recurrence, or I'll always think back to that time.
So when we talk about these physical conditions, why do we then need to talk about mental health?
Mental health and these physical conditions are inextricably linked for many reasons. Number one, when a person gets a diagnosis of a significant chronic physical illness, there's often a period of grief and adjustment. Mm-hmm. A person may recognize my life is about to change. They may need to leave work. They may need to go on disability. They're definitely going to have to change the way they spend their time. Some people may immediately need to get a surgical treatment or some kind of intensive medical treatment like chemotherapy or radiation or some other surgical treatments. This might be a financial stressor. Everything may not be covered. So people might be experiencing significant stress reactions and anxiety. But we also have to remember, people who may already have mental health issues, who may have a history of depression, a history of anxiety, or any number of other long-standing mental health issues, for example, even a personality disorder, the stress of a major medical diagnosis can exacerbate their existing mental health symptoms, or can be enough of a stressor that it might even foster the onset of significant psychiatric symptoms. So either it's long-standing mental health conditions, or it can really get those symptoms going. A person, for example, having paralytic anxiety. They can't sleep. They can't stop thinking about this diagnosis and being fearful of it. Then we have to look at the next step of this, which is mental health symptoms can interfere with how someone engages in their own medical treatment. So, for example, there's a very robust literature showing that having mental health symptoms, depression, anxiety, a history of past or ongoing, particularly ongoing substance use, but anything that impacts mental health can negatively affect adherence to pills you're being given to take at home, physical therapy, showing up at doctor's appointments, anything that requires follow through on the patient's behalf as they go on. And also having mental health issues can negatively impact social support networks. It's quite possible, and we know this, that people living with mental illness often have smaller and less robust social support networks, which again, is going to give that person less support at exactly the time they need it as they're trying to traverse the really complicated space of managing a medical illness. So this is almost like it's the impact of mental health and mental illness is coming at this from all sides. Before a person's diagnosed, coping with the initial, you know, the initial shock of being diagnosed with an illness, adjusting to the acute treatment, to the long-term treatment. And then we also know that mental health issues, mental illness can negatively impact lifestyle choices. Mm. We know that people living with mental illness often don't have as good sleep schedules. They often have poorer nutrition, poorer stress, coping with stress. All of those things can exacerbate the kinds of lifestyle behavior changes we need to see in someone. That I should say, all of these things can limit how well a person engages in the lifestyle changes they need to engage in the long-term follow-up after being diagnosed with a life-threatening illness. So as you can see, this is every step of the way.
Yeah.
And so in the best possible model, we would have what we call integrated primary care, where a person's mental health and medical health is constantly coming together, that there's a team, not just of medical professionals and specialists, but also mental health professionals who are well versed in the course,
yes,
of this particular illness, so they can work with both the patient and the patient's family.
Yes. And speaking of the patient's family, I think that is an area that is not discussed enough.
Mm-mm.
The mental health impacts of,
mm-hmm,
having a mother or the matriarch,
yeah, mm-hmm,
or patriarch of the,
mm-hmm,
family getting this diagnosis. What impacts have you seen in your private practice from the family members who are having to struggle through that?
The impact on family members is so, so challenging. Because you've got to remember, every member of a family is often affected. If it's a parent, their children, whether they're adult children or still minor children, a spouse, extended family who might be living far away and feel very helpless,
mm-hmm,
because they can't be there with them. But supporters go beyond just the family. Very close friends, extended family, coworkers and colleagues who often see you more often than your friends and family do because they're with you all day.
True.
So the network of people who are impacted when somebody receives a sort of a life-altering medical diagnosis, it can result in significant anxiety and negative mood symptoms in people who are loved ones or friends or colleagues of the person who is ill. It can result in rumination, guilt, because they feel like, why did it happen to them? I wish it had happened to me instead, especially when it's a child or even an adult child who gets diagnosed and not the parent. There is a sense of helplessness,
mm-hmm,
and hopelessness, that you can't take away the fear, that you can't take away the discomfort,
mm-hmm,
and you can't take away the diagnosis. So there's a lot of reactions, and they differentially affect people. Not everyone in the same family is going to be affected the same way. Some people are in a state of denial. Some people will be in a state of agitation. But by and large, the prevailing theme I hear from people is how helpless they feel, mm-hmm, about not knowing what to do or how to be there for someone when they're going through an illness. And down the line, Kyle, because that's in the acute phase, but months or years down the road, sometimes the people around them will start reporting burnout and caregiver burden, because it's quite possible that other people in the family system are now having to hold more of the burden of things that need to be done around the house and other duties, as well as having to take care of the person who's ill. And then the sense of guilt that, well, I shouldn't feel bad. They're sick, but the people doing the caregiving are burning out too,
mm-hmm,
which is its own phenomenon. So this is, again, very complicated. And a lot of it has to do about where we're catching someone and sort of the span of this particular long-term medical illness.
Mental health impacts all of us, and those with a life-changing diagnosis like cancer are no exception. MedCircle is teaming up with F Cancer for this Giving Tuesday to raise funds for those in need. If you're interested in being part of this digital fundraiser, use the links below this video. We'd love to see you there and raise a ton of money for F cancer. Because you know what? F cancer. Remember, whatever you're going through, you got this.
This is a topic very close to me. When I was 13, my mother was diagnosed with cancer, and she battled it for 3 years, and then she died. And it was certainly the most impactful thing that happened to me as a child, and it changed our entire family dynamic. Oh my gosh, all of a sudden, my best friend is gone, and I'm here with my dad and my brother going, who are you guys again?
Yeah, right, right.
Because I was always just with my mother. So I'm really interested to hear in later sessions how parents can correctly communicate this to their children without lying to them, but still getting the message across in a nice way.
Yes.
What I want to know right now, though, is how can taking care of one's mental health improve possibly the outcome of their prognosis?
So here's where it becomes an interesting conversation, that in my ideal universe, people would be taking care of their mental health with the same vigor they take care of their physical health.
Yeah.
That there would be annual mental health physicals, that you would get checkups, that you would get assessed for anxiety, depression, maladaptive health behaviors, all of that. So we can kind of do a calibration every year. That's not, unfortunately, how the world works. So long-term, lifelong mental health care, stress management, adhering to healthy behaviors, maintaining healthy social networks, having meaningful and purposeful activities, that's always going to keep a lot of gas in your psychological tank. So that when you are hit with a life-altering crisis, like a medical crisis, you may be more likely to be more resilient in the face of it. But again, like I said, that's not always how the world works. So when a person is faced down with such a diagnosis and is feeling like, I don't know what to do, it's not just one approach. In order to really shore up your mental health in the face of this, this means several things. I cannot think of a better time for people to be in therapy, and ideally with a therapist who's trained to work with individuals who are managing medical health issues. There's a whole discipline of health psychology that actually we've talked about on MedCircle. And in this discipline are people who are trained. Actually, that was my training. I was trained in clinical health psychology originally to work with individuals who are also managing what we call comorbid or co-occurring is a better term, co-occurring medical and physical health issues to help, you know, to sort of, they're trained to understand the pitfalls, but also the grief and the stress and all the things that go along with it. But being in therapy is critical because many times people, when they get a diagnosis like this, they're terrified for themselves. They don't want to make their families worry. They don't want to share their fears with their family members, but they want a place to talk about them. And guess what? A person is not defined by their physical illness.
That's right.
They still have other stuff going on
That's
in their
right.
lives.
Right.
You know what? They may have had marital problems going into this diagnosis. They may not want to talk to their spouse. They may need that other space. So I think that's one place, is that therapy becomes important. Number two is to work with your healthcare provider, if this is something that works with you, on finding support groups. Some people find tremendous solace and knowing there's someone else going through this. Other people don't feel like they want to talk to strangers. That's a personal decision. Many people do find it useful. And those can either be in person or virtual. People will sometimes find online groups, even on social media platforms, of people who have come together, share, you know, in sort of sharing their experience with whatever the health issue is. Number three is to maintain as much purposeful, meaningful, and enjoyable activity in your life as possible. That could mean for some people continuing to work, even if it's on a part-time basis. For some people, that means not working because their job isn't gratifying or it's too stressful. Whatever level of exercise you're permitted to engage in, given your medical condition, other activities that give you pleasure, being with friends, doing a hobby, but maintaining that piece of your life because it connects you to the things and the activities and the people, perhaps, that give you joy. And then practicing other health behaviors, sleeping as much as you can under these conditions, good nutrition, activity, like all of the things that keep us healthy. And no matter whether we're ill or not, it's very important at this point in someone's life that all of that needs to be happening. And it really should be something that happens right away.
Dr.
Dr. Rami, I think a lot of people think that there is a correct way to respond to getting that initial diagnosis. Is there a correct way?
There's absolutely not a correct way. I mean, people have reactions ranging from grief to anger to denial to sadness, and in some cases even relief.
Hmm. Explain the relief part.
That a person may have been having all kinds of symptoms and couldn't make sense of them,
right,
and their quality of life was diminishing and they couldn't figure it out, and a diagnosis at least gives them a plan.
Yes.
It may still be unsettling, but like, okay, now at least I know there's a treatment we're going to follow, because until then they might have felt like, I don't even understand what's happening. The fact is, relief is probably not going to be a common reaction to getting a severe medical diagnosis. By and large, the reactions tend to be fear, terror, denial, hopelessness, helplessness, confusion. They
anger.
Tend to be anger.
Yeah.
They tend to be negative emotional states. That's the norm. And for the person experiencing them, you know, there's no wrong reaction.
Mm.
And there are certain historic factors that can make the reaction even more complicated. For example, a person with a history of trauma may receive this kind of traumatic news even harder. So people with longstanding histories of mental illness, mental health issues, it may be harder to receive this news as well. So there are certain underlying factors that can also impact how somebody receives news of an illness. But again, there is no right answer. Any way a person responds is the right answer.
In the age of social media, there seems to be a popular way of going about fighting a big disease like cancer by posting it on Instagram and being very transparent with your treatment, which can oftentimes pressure other people struggling with cancer to do the same thing, but they don't have to do that.
No, I think that we live in an interesting time, right? In the macro, Kyle, I actually think it's so important that everyone know that however they want to talk about whatever they're going through, illness or otherwise, be open and received in a non-judgmental space.
Mm-hmm.
So I completely, I'm actually very happy when I hear people say, I have an illness and I want the world to know about it. It helps me feel better.
Yes.
In the same breath though, some people, that's just not their natural way. They're terrified. They don't want to share it with the world, and they often feel diagnosis shamed or share shamed.
Mm.
Like they feel like they have to share, and they're not supposed. They feel like they have to share, and they don't want to, or they're too scared to, or they don't feel like a hero.
Mm-hmm.
They just want this all to go away. You know, I have one friend in particular. I remember watching her go through her journey with breast cancer, and she really, really was burning out under people saying, come on, I'm your cancer cheerleader and you can do this. And she said, I don't want to be a cancer cheerleader. I want to get better. I'm terrified. I don't want to talk about this with people I don't know. And the only thing I could do as her friend is give her permission and say, you don't have to talk to anybody if you don't want.
Mm-hmm.
This is your body, your story, your journey, your experience. And so I do think in sort of the sharing world we live in, maybe merits for some, it's not for everyone. And that for people who are going through this and want this to be a very private experience, they may not want to share it with anyone but their physician.
Right.
And that's their prerogative.
When somebody's sitting in that physician's office and they get that information or they get that phone call, they obviously can have a range of emotions.
Yeah.
From a mental health standpoint, what would you suggest they do in that moment?
You know, in that moment, one thing I would suggest, and this is something, it's actually interesting. This came of a lecture I was at last week.
Mm-hmm.
And this woman worked in the area of crisis. She focused on people who are in periods of crisis. And she said that one of the most important things you can ask people at a time of crisis, especially to someone who's like a physician or first responder, what question am I not asking right now?
Great question.
She's a genius. I have to look up her name so maybe we can even put her name up on MedCircle, because it was such a wise thing, because what am I not asking? So if people would have the wherewithal to do that, once upon a time, Kyle, back when I was in training, it was the late 90s. It was mid to late 90s. And I was training at UCLA in a breast cancer treatment program as part of my health psychology training. And one of the things that they did there, and this to tell you was the 90s, it was a long time ago, This was a place where women were coming to get a second opinion about how to proceed with breast cancer treatment. It was a very uniquely designed clinic, but the piece I want to talk about here is they gave every woman a tape recorder and a stack of cassette tapes because it was before digital recorders. They made the women record every specialist they talked to that day. And I think that in a case when someone's getting this diagnosis, ideally they're with someone else, that they might even ask their physician, can I record this conversation? Because you're about to tell me things I might forget. Ask them, is there something I haven't asked you yet? But actually get in there and hopefully there's someone else in the room with you. Mm-hmm. I also think though that this might be a multi-step conversation. When you first get the diagnosis, you might be so overwhelmed that you need a second, third, or even fourth conversation about this. Right. Some people might find it useful to be done in writing. I know where I get my healthcare, there's a portal through which we can email healthcare providers. It may be, I need to see this in writing. Mm-hmm. Some people might find that useful. Some people may get information on the phone and say, I need to come in person. Mm-hmm. You've got to figure out the way. And you want to get the information? Do you need to record it? Do you need to get it in writing? Do you need to write questions out ahead of time? Would you do better if you were with someone else? I would say more often than not, people would do better if someone else was there because it's a second pair of ears, hearing and asking questions.
Yeah.
But give it a beat.
Yes.
You know, for it to settle in, and that you're not probably not going to get all of the information you want in one fell swoop, and keep composing questions that you need answered.
Yeah. I spoke to somebody who had gone through cancer before this shoot, and she said when she got the diagnosis, she felt like she was in a state of emergency. And yeah. Obviously that makes sense. But she said, I didn't even know what the doctor was telling me.
Yeah.
I didn't
yeah.
know what the disease was. I didn't know how mm-hmm. it was going to mm-hmm. look. I didn't know what the treatment plans were. I knew nothing, but I was in the state of emergency. So she said her advice to other women, in her case, it was breast cancer. She said her advice to other women is that, yes, it's urgent, but right now in that moment, it may not be an emergency. Mm-hmm. And her advice was the first step was to just learn what you can, mm-hmm. because most of us go in mm-hmm. to a doctor because we are not the doctor and we don't know
That's
anything
right.
about
That's
this
right.
thing. Yeah.
And I think that though you said, when the woman you were talking to said she was in a state of emergency, what does happen to us when we get this kind of information? Our sympathetic nervous system is on. And that is the worst place to be processing information
right.
from.
Right.
You know, we almost go into a state of mini paralysis, right? We're not taking in information well. Mm-hmm. So that's why I'm saying you almost need to wait a beat and go back in as some of it sinks in. Because once that fight, flight, or freeze reaction happens, we're immediately like, what do I need to do? Where do I need to go? What do I need to prepare? Or I blah, blah, blah. I can't hear anything
right.
you're saying to me, that we really need to give people a minute to process. You're not going to get it all in that first phone call.
Yeah. We know everyone responds differently, but for the supporters listening to this, what could some of the feelings that their loved one is feeling when they get this diagnosis?
So when your loved one is getting this diagnosis, the mm-hmm. person who's actually experiencing the illness, they're going to experience everything from grief to rage to sadness to confusion to despair to like denial and to, like I said, to relief.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there can be any number of reactions. Your family member might even be a matter of fact. They may turn to you and say, that was the doctor. Turns out I do have ALS. Turns mm-hmm. out I do have muscular dystrophy. And you're sobbing and this person almost looks, the person who actually has the illness, may look numb.
Mm-hmm.
A person can have any number of reactions. There is no right reaction.
Huge.
And what's really important is as the supporter and loved one, you may feel like you want to talk about it. You want to process mm-hmm. it. They're the ones leading the dance at this point.
Yeah.
If they say, I need to go take a little bit of time by myself, then you say, that is fine.
Yes.
I am right here on the other side of this door. But you don't say, no, 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 no. How dare you pull away from me? We're in this together.
Yeah.
Don't make this about you. This is about them.
Now, that denial word stuck out to me because mm-hmm. for me, I'm imagining my loved one who's in denial. And I'm saying, look, this is serious. Mm-hmm. We have to take mm-hmm. this seriously. And you're acting like mm-hmm. it's the common cold.
Mm-hmm.
How do I have that conversation, or do I?
It depends on how long the denial lasts for. If you're in the initial minutes and hours after somebody being informed
yes.
of a diagnosis, denial would be, it's almost like, again, it's that first stage of grief. What starts getting tricky is if now the clock is ticking, a day or two, three or four has passed by, the healthcare provider has indicated very clearly, you need to come in tomorrow, and they're not following through on the appointment. Uh-huh. That's where you're going to probably have to muscle up, double down, and get the healthcare provider involved, mm-hmm. that you may not be able to do this alone. You're not going to get here through brute force by screaming at them and by yelling at them. Mm-hmm. You may do well by giving them a forum to talk about this, mm-hmm. and instead of saying, becoming hysterical and saying, we got to get in and deal with this, mm-hmm. to say, what are you feeling right now? Do you feel comfortable sharing that? And say, I hear you. Mm-hmm. This is terrifying. Mm-hmm. And they'll say, I'm not terrified. I just can't be bothered right now. And then so you say, okay, whatever it is, your healthcare provider saying, come in for another appointment. Can we just go in for the other appointment? Mm-hmm. But you may have to literally bring in the healthcare provider to also lead the conversations. And there are some people in denial who will wait and wait and wait. And it can get to be really, really concerning and frightening, because the fact is, unless they're incapacitated, there's right. really not much you can do in terms of forcing them into care. So instead of trying to beat them over the head with it, you really want to say, I hear you. You're not too worried right now. That's great. However, they're strongly suggesting we take the appointment today. Can we just go and hear what they have to say?
For those people out there who go into grief when they get this diagnosis, what are your tips and advice for them?
You're going to go into grief when you get, so it's not even like for those who, all will.
All will.
You know, so everyone will go into some period of grief. It's because grief is adjustment. Right? Grief is adjustment to loss.
Grief is adjustment. Wow. Yes.
You know, it's not, grief is not a process to be pathologized. It's actually the human psyche doing what it does when there's loss. And when a person gets a diagnosis, that is a loss. Mm-hmm. It's a loss potentially of quality of life, of certain physical functionality. Certainly it could even be the loss of time. You may have a foreshortened future. All of that said, we know the classical stages of grief, of denial, anger, bargaining, depression, and acceptance. They don't always go linearly. A person can go from denial to bargaining to acceptance back to depression. I mean, they can cycle through, but it is, you will go through stages. And some people initially will have that numb denial, and then they'll be like, I can't believe this is happening. This is so unjust. This is so unfair. You know, they'll start seeing different doctors. Sometimes people go a second, third, fourth, tenth opinion. That can be part of the bargaining as well. Mm-hmm. Getting second opinions is important, but there's a point at which sometimes a person is now, there actually might be prolonging some situations, but they're going to go through those stages. Being supported during those stages, though, is really, really important for a person to be able to talk to someone who's trained in this, to walk them through those stages of grief, and for the person to not feel like there's something wrong with them because they're going through grief. We so reserve the word grief for loss secondary to death.
Death, right.
That's just one form of grief.
And don't you feel like we rush people through grief?
Absolutely.
Like, oh, it's going to be okay. Yeah. We're in this together. It's like, let them have a moment. Goodness.
The more you try to rush grief, the longer you're protracting the process. Grief is personal, and it is not going to go according to anyone's schedule. The more we give grief space to sort of run its way through, the more likely we are to have a better outcome for the person who's experiencing it. Because sometimes when people are going through grief, they feel guilty. I'm taking too long. Oh, I got to stop this. Yes. I got to stop all this crying.
Right.
No, you don't.
You don't.
No, you don't.
You don't.
You sit here. I've had clients come in who are grieving over a diagnosis. I say, you are welcome to sit here for an hour. I got nothing but Kleenex in that cabinet. Okay. We will sit here and you will cry.
Yeah.
And in between those tears, you want to talk, you talk.
Yeah.
And we can do this for weeks.
Yeah.
And then at some point, given the permission, I've had many clients say they cry for a while and then say, okay, I'm good. Like, emotion works its way through us. Yeah. We really, these emotional systems in us are actually pretty well designed. It's that just that we fight them.
Right.
That they become a problem.
Yes. And that reminds me, we did a series on somatic experiencing. Mm-hmm. And if that
social workers or psychologists whose focus is to help people know how to best communicate with family members. Oftentimes a person who is in a long-term committed relationship or a marriage will tell that person first, because that is the person who will often be sort of the point of contact and will be working with other family members. Informing children, for example, is going to have a lot to do with the age of the children. Obviously, adolescent children, in many cases, will be able to receive the information as an adult would, but they may need very different kinds of supports, probably more intensive support. You know this better than I would. You lost a mom when you were a teenager. And many times when I think about your story, Kyle, it strikes me how painful that is. I have a 16-year-old daughter, mm-hmm. and the idea of her coping with my loss is something I simply can't get my head around. Mm-hmm. So what you had to go through, you know, to think about what supports would have been useful for you at that time, probably would have been different for you at 16 than they would have even been at 26.
Absolutely.
You know, you're still in school. There's still a reliance you have on a parent. Mm-hmm. And so I think that developmentally, they can hear it. You really need to be there and to support them, open conversations about it, ensuring that they have whatever therapeutic support that they need. With younger children, it definitely would behoove a person to work with their own pediatrician that might know their child, explain to them what's happening, and see what guidance they can get from them. A pediatrician is likely to have referrals or resources in terms of maybe even knowing a developmental pediatrician, child psychiatrist, child social worker, somebody who is well-versed in talking about illness with children. This conversation is going to be guided in part by prognosis. Is the parent's physical ability going to change? Is their appearance going to change? For example, a parent potentially losing hair due to chemotherapy. There's many things a child who's younger are going to need to be prepared for. So the conversations in many ways are going to be steered by that, and having professionals who are well-versed at different developmental stages at how to have these conversations, or even the help caregivers you bring into the home. You may need help with your children and the kind of consistency that might be needed at that point. It may help to have a family member come in and be that extra pair of hands, or a long relied upon nanny may end up spending more hours with the child, but you want to give them as much consistency as possible. This is definitely not a time to really be keeping secrets. It's really about meeting family members where they're at and how they can manage hearing the information. I think that what is very useful is that if a person gets a diagnosis like this of a long-term, severe, life-changing, chronic medical illness, that they do have someone in their life who is their point person, who helps them organize the information. In the best of scenarios, you've got someone who's kind of got the answers. Yeah, they're getting chemo. No, they're not getting surgery. They're going to be here. They're going to be there. So like there can be some answers. So the person who's experiencing the illness is not being barraged with questions and answers. So it's like, this is where we're at. We'll keep you posted. And again, different families have different boundaries, different styles of communicating. So there's really no one right answer. But I do think having that one person in the system, it may or may not be a spouse or partner. It could be a parent. It could be a sibling. But that person who's a go-to.
That's really interesting. When we're talking to the young kids especially, are there things that no matter what the prognosis is, no matter what the situation is, that we shouldn't do?
I think completely keeping it a so-called secret, you know, that letting the child know something's going on, but trying to protect them from things like fear. So keeping it entirely business as usual, that might really depend on the developmental phase. You're not going to tell an infant. The infant's not going to be able to uptake the information. But once, I think that lying to them would be like deliberately lying, you know, that, that something isn't happening that is, or is happening that isn't, or something like that. That might leave a child, even at a young age, feeling betrayed. Again, because it's going to be so different based on prognosis and different aspects of the illness, like I said, changes in appearance or functionality, and the age of the child is going to matter, is where I'm really going to defer to somebody whose expertise is like going to, I would say, take it to the expert. If this was even happening in my family,
right?
If I had a 5-year-old child,
right,
I would say, I need to talk to someone about how to talk about this to my child. I had once a child who was very ill. My younger daughter once fell very ill when she was 2 years old and was sort of touch and go there. And although it was only for a short period of time, when I was in the middle of that short period of time, I didn't know where the end was. Her sister was 5. And so for me, one of the questions I had had is, what do I tell her 5-year-old sister who's wondering why her mom has moved into the hospital and her sister's in the hospital? And one thing that I found useful in talking to the medical social workers at this hospital was, don't be alarmist. You know, let her know her sister is sick, and if we can get clearance for her to come and play with her. So her older sister came into, there's like a playroom in the hospital on the pediatric floor. She'd come and play with her. So I was also having to ensure that my 5-year-old had a routine. And so I had to bring, my mom came in, made sure my 5-year-old was on a routine. I was in the hospital trying to keep my 2-year-old on a routine. We did not scare her sister, but I also didn't keep her older sister away from her, which I think would have been very unsettling. So, but that was with the help of people who worked in the hospital who kind of helped me figure this all out.
Yeah. I'm reflecting on how my parents communicated that information to me when my mom was diagnosed with cancer. And they told me up front, she has cancer. And I said, okay. You know, and then they said, we're going to treat it through chemo and here's what you can expect. And I was fine with all that. What I wish they would have done, and of course, hindsight, and they did the best they could. I'm not placing judgment or blame on them today. But what I wish would have happened is, about a year into it, I was led to believe, whether it was inadvertently or not, that the worst was behind us and recovery is now about to happen.
I see. Yes.
And it wasn't until the following year where I go, now hold on. I thought you said recovery. Mm-hmm. We were on recovery path, but she's doing more chemo and she looks worse than she did. And she's sleeping 22 hours a day. And I remember calling my mom and saying, you still have cancer, don't you? And she said, yeah, I do. And I go, I thought you didn't. She said, well, no, I still have it. And I remember I felt cheated.
Yes.
I felt out of the loop. Mm-hmm. And as someone who at the time really thrived with control and information was control for me, I really didn't appreciate that. Yeah.
Yeah. And I think that as an adult man, you can look back on that and see it through a slight lens of betrayal. I think if it happened to you as a child, you might have felt the same way too. We underestimate the unbelievable capacity for empathy that children have.
Yeah.
And children appreciate what time is.
Yeah.
And that you can really find a way, like set up structures so there is some playtime, even if mom or dad, whomever is sick, is fragile, that there can be routine. And I think that routine becomes very important, that maybe there is story time with that parent or they do a craft or something, but that's something predictable for both the child and for the parent, and that's their time together. And for that child, who may have to learn to become more gentle with a parent that's in pain from their illness, becomes an incredible place of empathy. But the predictability of it can be very, very important for a child, no matter what a child wants routine. And it may not be the old routine, but I think that, for example, secreting away the parent from the child, I can't imagine that.
Well, and for me, it was, I feel like I missed out on memories I could have had.
Yes.
Because I was a kid in high school.
Yep.
So on Saturday night, I went to the movies. Mm-hmm. I wish I would have not.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Because I don't remember the movies I saw or the
That's
people
right.
I saw the movies with.
Yeah.
But I remember leaving my mom.
Mm-hmm.
And I left because I thought,
she's fine.
I have my whole life.
Yep.
I did. I thought we were in a normal situation, and we weren't in a normal situation. And so that's still today. I go, I wish I would have behaved differently.
Yeah. And I think that that's where I think any family going through this, working with, if somebody in your family is ill, the family will have, the hospital will have social workers for you to talk with to really process this. You can read, you can get education, you can, you know, watch series like this, but it's important to know where your kid's at. Kids can actually sometimes handle a little more information than we think, but I also think that things like routine, structure, predictability, especially for the younger children, when there is a parent who's going through an illness, becomes very important. It becomes an entirely different conversation, obviously, when it's the child who's sick, because obviously that takes a toll on other children in the family and the parents and all that. This time we're sort of talking about it top down, that it's the parent or some other close family. It could be a grandparent too, especially if the grandparent is close to the child.
So we mentioned in a previous session on the role of guilt that a patient can place on themselves by thinking they are becoming too much of a burden on those around them. How do they manage those feelings?
Having a sense of guilt when a person is experiencing a severe chronic medical illness is quite common for a variety of reasons, being a burden, being expensive, everyone's worrying about me. Something like it's probably how they were before they had an illness.
Right.
Like, oh,
yeah,
I'm causing too much trouble and all of
course.
That. And so, and especially if they see their family is suffering, that they see that actually the medical bills are piling up, that, you know, somebody's really having a lot of caregiver burden, having to take care of them. It's absolutely critical. This is, again, I know I come back to this as an old standby, but mental health therapy exists for a reason. This is where therapy becomes critical as a place to process the guilt. And that might be individual therapy. It may even be couples therapy as a safe place for both of them to talk about, perhaps one spouse saying or one partner saying, this is a lot. And maybe they can start coming up with suggestions like respite care, mm-hmm. or other kinds of solutions that will allow for a little bit of a balance. Respite care is when a helper or some kind of caregiving is given. And this might matter, for example, if someone has central lines that need to be placed or is catheterized or needs some kind of nursing care that maybe a person who's not even a nurse can do, but bringing in someone in from time to time. Mm-hmm. So maybe the other partner can, I don't know, run errands, go skiing for a day, take a hike, go yeah. to work, whatever it is right. that might give them joy or pleasure or just what they need to do.
Yeah.
And so I think that therapy becomes critical because guilt is a feeling at this point, but it's sort of something that becomes a negative emotion that creates more stress and burden, and that having a conversation about it becomes important. Guilt is also something that can be really well processed in a support group feature where you see that other people are going through what you're going through too. Other people with cancer are having this reaction yeah. too. Talking about it, sometimes just knowing someone else feels guilty can dial down that feeling for you.
And when you bring up therapy, you bring it up because it is so effective.
Yes, it is.
Especially, I feel, when it is done as soon as possible.
Absolutely.
Before there is overwhelming feelings of guilt, before mm-hmm. there is a little bit of anger in the marriage mm-hmm. or resentment.
Who is experiencing a severe medical illness? False hope obviously can be dangerous for a lot of reasons. Number one, a person may have such unrealistic expectations that they're not able to cope when more and more bad news is coming down about prognosis or quality of life limitations and all of that. It may also delimit them from doing the kind of planning that needs to happen, true end life planning, while they still have clarity of thought, mm-hmm. estate planning, you know, planning for, you know, especially if there are, you know, if not even minor children, you know, young adult children, to be able to do that. If there's false hope, they may not be engaging that planning and using their time well at that time of their life. But then, and I think we probably see this even more, is the despair and the hopelessness mm-hmm. that it's, you know, all is lost, and that in fact they're, you know, that everything is gone, that the change in quality of life, you know, really is a state of despair rather than something that can be adjusted to. And what that statement gets at beautifully is the need for building in realistic expectations, flexibility, and preparation. Mm-hmm. And all of that happens from having a good structure around the patient socially, practically, through their medical team. Nobody can do this alone.
Yeah.
And so it's really that idea that the person, the people around them at home, at work, at, you know, in their healthcare setting are all working together. Having a severe medical illness doesn't mean that somebody stops working. For some people, continuing to work in some capacity is actually what does give them a little bit of hope. They still mm-hmm. get to use their mind, or they get to do the thing they love. They may not do as much of it. They may go onto a restricted schedule, but it's not like there's a one size fits all strategy. What those authors are referring to is the fact that there needs to be a strategy.
Right. Now, here's a big question. How does one combat hopelessness while keeping their outlook realistic?
Mm-hmm. So being realistic and having realistic hope is quite possible, because the question then becomes hope for what?
Mm.
And that has to be calibrated over time. So if a person indeed is now being told that the course of their illness is not proceeding well and that they are going to start experiencing more and more quality of life issues, that they might have difficulties with walking or self-care and all of that, that the realistic hope is that then, okay, there are limitations on being able to do this, this, and this. It's a constant recalibration. But I think the key isn't just about hope. It's about hope that's embedded in reality and what right. really, you see, I'm saying, like, hope that's a blind hope that, oh no, some miracle cure is going to come along. I remember once working with somebody, and this was socially, it wasn't even, you know, clinically. And in this particular case, he just come to me sort of feeling hopeless. His mom was quite ill with very advanced terminal cancer. And the family had been told repeatedly, this is not, you know, this is the end of her life. And she insisted on continuing to consult to tremendous costs. We're talking six figures, hundreds of thousands of dollars spent on people who definitely seemed to be selling her false cures and false hope. These false cures were not doing any harm to her. It was really, you know, like it was almost sugar water, if you will.
Mm-hmm.
But what it was doing was she was not directly addressing end of life. She had maybe 30 days and she was planning stuff out 6 and 7 months. It was incredibly painful for the family to witness. And I remember about 27 days after him and I had that conversation, she passed.
Wow.
And I think that, you know, in some ways they felt like a double loss. Like there was this, like almost like there was this innocence of her, like she was a child at that point. They felt frustrated and that it was her money. And so she was spending it as she wanted and that she was sort of being taken advantage of, but she was totally sound mind. She really believed. So for him, he thought it might have co-opted how she would have spent the last 27 days of her life had she known differently. Interestingly, she stayed completely mentally clear to the end, other than having this false hope. So hope is a complicated conversation, but I do think it's about infusing it with reality.
Right.
That somebody really sitting with a person saying, okay, here's what is going to happen. Your physical infirmity means that the odds of you being able to still walk on your own in about a month or two are going to be limited. So maybe the person then is working with their family, getting their home ready mm-hmm. for that.
Yes.
You know, that sort of thing. Maybe taking a last trip to a place where it'll still be doable. Whatever the things are the person wants, but it has to be realistic.
Could we just call that acceptance?
It is acceptance. I mean, realistic hope is acceptance. I agree with that. That's well put in the sense that, you know, you see a future that's going to be different than the one you had. You'll mm-hmm. think about how you can function in that future as fully and meaningfully and purposefully as you can. And so there is that sense of acceptance that now this illness is in my life. I've worked with many people who have pushed through long-term chronic illnesses. One thing that they repeatedly talk about is that even though they're better, kind of back online in terms of they're not going in for regular medical treatments, anything more, is fatigue. Mm. They're wiped out like they were never before. They'll say, you know, just the act of kind of getting through my morning routine into midday and I'm feeling tired. And they're saying, I feel like I'm too young to be taking an afternoon nap, but that's what I need. That to me, and then they let themselves have the nap. Mm-hmm. That's realistic hope mm-hmm. and understand that, okay, maybe I can do a couple of hours. What I used to work 10 hours a day, I can do 2 or 3 hours a day. When I used to do a long commute, I can't do that anymore. Mm-hmm. And that's the acceptance, the realistic hope, the idea that life does look different now.
Now, I'm going to bring up the topic of resilience. Mm-hmm. What role does that play? And how does somebody maintain healthy resilience through this time?
So resilience is an interesting term, right? Because we still wonder, is resilience something that we fully cultivate? How much of it is something that someone's born with? I often view resilience as a bucket. A bucket or a box or a bag that holds lots of other things. It holds, you know, social capital, the people you can access around you, your belief in the things you can get done and your thoughts about the world, the future, your capacity. So it's partly thinking. It's partly structural. It's partly social support. A lot of it is about beliefs and all of that together make up this thing called resilience. There's also a big piece of flexibility in this. So people who are more resilient tend to be more flexible. They can change more quickly and kind of go with the change. There's a real dynamic quality to them. And you can imagine if you have a chronic medical illness, to be able to be dynamic and say, yeah, we're going to have to change to this treatment now. We're going to have to move you to this hospital. Turns out that you're going to have to be on dialysis a while longer. That those kinds of pieces of news can be devastating for someone. And the more resilience you have, the more you can say, okay, this is going to be hard, but I know I can do this. Mm-hmm. That statement, I know I can do this, is resilience. Mm. So it's definitely a buffer against the stress and the negative emotional reactions that having a long-term illness, that impact of that on a person.
So when people say, I can't do this,
Yeah, that shows.
What do they do to move to the can do this?
So when a person really saying, I cannot do this, that what you want to do is let them talk out their can't-ness first.
Okay.
I hear you. So you really feel like you can't talk to me about that. And then this is something I talk a lot about with my own clients and people when I'm talking about, you know, doing therapy. I call it emotional resistance training. You've told me all your can'ts. Now play a game with me here. Tell me your can'ts.
Ooh, it's good.
Okay, you
can't.
And
I like that you said game too.
Yeah. Just tell me. And I do this with clients all the time. They say, even as I'm saying this to you, Doc, I don't believe what I'm saying. I say, I don't care if you believe it.
Right.
Just tell me from what you can do.
Yeah.
Can you stand up? Show me.
Yeah.
You know, can you whatever? And they'll sometimes they'll even, there'll be a glint in their eye and like, okay, you know, and they'll be frustrated with me. But I call it resistance training because I'm saying that you've pulled it this way. Now I want you to pull it this way. Okay. You got this and we're going to pull it back.
Yeah.
And the idea of that game is that I'm trying to help them lay down new tracks, new muscle memory.
Yes.
And that like we'll do it through journaling. We'll practice it in session. There'll be lots of ways they have to, like, if you say, every time you give yourself a can't, you have to promise me you're going to give yourself a can, even if the can doesn't ring true, right? And so it's just sort of a back and forth, and slowly but surely, we do try to change the self-talk. We try to come up with alternative thoughts. And that's a big part of coping with chronic illness, is changing the conversation about what they can't do to the things that they can do. And part of what's so hard is they used to be able to can do many, many more things. The list of cans may have shortened. Right. So it's just easier to say, I can't.
Right. You spoke about exhaustion. For someone who's possibly going to chemotherapy and radiation, and they don't feel like they can go sit in a therapist's office in addition to that, what is your response to them?
Fair. Okay. Exhaustion is very, very real. And so again, we go back to the realistic hope and the realistic expectations. What can you fit in a day? It may be too much to get up, go to chemo, and go to therapy in one day. Some people might be working with a therapist that's willing to do it via teletherapy, that they can talk to their therapist from bed. I've done that with many clients with chronic illnesses. They find tremendous comfort in therapy, but they just can't. They don't even have the energy to either get in an Uber or certainly not drive themselves. It's like, okay, you know, we have our set time and they call me at 1 o'clock and we do their session right there through, you know, I have sort of this online platform I'm able to use with them so that they have a confidential session and we're talking and they're at least they're lying down. It's more comfortable and then they can take some rest afterwards. Having shorter sessions. We assume an hour, 45 minutes, 50 minutes. I don't even know where that number came from.
Right.
In a lot of primary care settings, there's more talk of doing 30-minute or even 15 to 20-minute little boosters. Another thing that can happen is that the therapy can be integrated at the time you go for chemotherapy. That if that clinic can provide those things in an integrated manner, that if you're making one trip and you can get it all done together. But it's really making a list of what is your must-do today. Maybe that's just one thing you knock off all day, get that done, and then go home and take the rest you need. But have like one benchmark for the day. For some people, when they get a medical diagnosis like this, part of their defiance and their denial is, I'm going to keep up my old schedule.
Yes.
Because in that way, you're not sick.
That's right.
That's how I'm going to go back to my old schedule. And that means everything's fine. And, but the fact is putting yourself through that much exhaustion can actually harm your healing. Therefore, is to not bring more distress into the life of the person who's already experiencing the illness, to be as empathic as possible, and to find out how you can be helpful to them, even if that just means doing nothing. And that's where people get frustrated, is if the thing they're being asked to do is nothing.
Yeah. I remember when my mother died, and I would tell people my mother died. Granted, this is a little different, but they would always respond with their story of losing a grandfather or somebody in their life. And I couldn't then switch my brain to be there for them.
Exactly.
And I really just wanted it to be about me for this moment. And they couldn't do that.
Right.
And so I'm very cognizant now when people share something with me, I don't immediately go to my how I can relate to that. I try to be make
in
it all about
story.
Them.
Yes.
Yeah, in their story.
Yes. And ask them, how are you feeling? Are you know, how are you doing?
Yeah.
Just be there for them. Give them the opportunity. And they're like, I'm fine, I'm fine. And then just say, how, you know, is there anything I can do to help? And if they say no, let them know I'm here, you know, for anything. If you want to talk, if you want to distract, I'm here. Just let me know. And, but here's the thing. Don't put the entire onus on them. That doesn't mean you have to keep calling them like every day, but I would definitely reach out. You know, it might be, and you know, your friend, is it their text friend? They're a, you know, instant message friend. They're a phone call friend, you know. And figure out those ways. And you might even know enough about their rhythms in their life. Sometimes when a person is adjusting to the shock of having been diagnosed with an illness that's going to result in significant life change, they may not even know what to ask for. But if you know this person, you may very well know if they have to pick up their kids from school at 2:30, and that might be a little bit of a challenging thing, say, you know what? I got the school drop off. I've got the school pickup this week, or maybe the drop off. So they might need rest, or if they have to go into the hospital, anticipate the issues.
Yes.
Trash cans that may need to be pulled in, kids that need to be picked up, laundry that may need to be folded. And, you know, you can even build in and say, hey, listen, I'm going to come by. We're both loving watching, binge watching the show.
Yeah.
How about we just, we'll fold up that laundry together, meaning that hopefully you're doing most of it and you're watching with them. Figure out the little places you can help. Sometimes people want to come in as big ticket heroes, right? Like, I want to be the one who's going to drive you to surgery and sit by your bed. They may actually need help on the home front.
That's right.
You know, quietly figure out what those things are and help some of those. And even just say, you know, listen, I've got this part taken care of. Mm-hmm. And sometimes people would be like, oh my goodness.
That just made me feel so good, because it is a good question to ask, what can I do, or is there anything I can do? But a better thing to say is, hey, I got this thing on Friday.
And anticipate it to a point. Like, you might say, well, I'm going to buy them $500 worth of groceries and fill their freezer. They may not want you to fill their freezer, and you may fill their freezer with stuff they don't want.
Right.
You know, so say, listen, what, you know, I know that Mary has soccer every Thursday until 6, and that's pushing into dinner time. How about I bring over, and they might say, great, versus, you know, bring in a catering truck to their
house.
That's right. Like, you don't want this to be heavy handed.
Yes. For people who are far away across the country, I mean, distance wise, how can they support that person?
This is a tough one, because especially when this is someone you're close to, it could be a family member, very, very dear friend. You know, there's different approaches people have to this. Now, in some cases, if it is someone very, very close to you, a parent, an adult child, a grandchild, you may feel like, I've got to be there. Check in with them and say, listen, I'm going to head there. You may need my support, but be mindful in that decision. If you do end up going over there, they may not have room in their house. You may need to either stay with another friend or family who lives in the area, or take a hotel. Like, be aware that you're not creating a burden by just showing up. But if you want to be in the hospital, be helpful. Again, be aware of how you can be helpful. But if it's long term, if it's weeks or months, and you have a job or you have other responsibilities where you live and that person lives far away, you may be more limited in helping them in sort of the day to day instrumental. I'll pick the kids up from school, I'll drive you to a doctor's appointment sort of thing. And so what ends up happening is figuring out from your relationship with them what they may need. At a minimum, reach out and always let them know, you don't need to pick up the phone. I'm calling you to let you know I'm here. These days, everyone on their phone is able to see who's calling. It's not like the old days.
Right.
You don't need to pick up.
Right.
If I am of use to you, pick up.
Yeah.
I'm thinking of you.
Yes.
Let them know that. Because the last thing, again, playing into that guilt theme, is like, oh my gosh, they keep calling, I don't answer. They may be struggling with their own anxiety and depression, helplessness, hopelessness, exhaustion, being overwhelmed, and the responsibilities of their lives and maybe their medical treatments. They may not have it to talk to you. And one thing that really angers me is when I do see dynamics where a person thinks they're being helpful to someone who's sick, and they keep calling them and reaching in, and they actually get angry. Like, I keep calling them and they don't answer the phone. And I'm like, okay, they're going through a lot. Your phone call is not their priority. So this isn't about you.
Right.
It's about them.
That's right.
And so I think that it's really, you know, for some people, it's reaching out. Like I said, could be texts. It could be phone calls. I tell people, maybe lay off on too many of the internet articles you're reading about this condition and always sending them links.
Please lay off.
It really can be a bit much. I know a few people close to me have managed, you know, chronic illness issues in their families, and they're saying, if one more person sends me, and often a poorly researched article on something, they're like, do they not think I don't have Google? Like,
right.
I can't look this up.
Yeah. Right.
And so there's a frustration, because once again, it's this burden that they feel like, I have to respond to this. I really don't care about this. And so whatever you do in trying to help someone from a distance, don't add to their burden to help you feel better.
Huge.
So that's really, really important. And figure out that dance with them. You may also have contact with other stakeholders near them. For example, let's say it's your sister who lives on the other side of the country. You yourself have a job and family here, and your sister is, you know, has being treated for cancer, and she's married, and you get along fine with her husband. Her husband or her wife may be your point of contact. Mm-hmm. Then you talk to the partner and you say, hey, listen, you know, how can I be helpful? And they may be able to tell you more realistically what is or isn't needed. So there may be sort of different ways also to communicate with the family. It may not always be directly with the person who is the patient, but with other people in the system who might say, you know what, she's not asking you, but it would be really great if you could come out here and then listen to them.
Well, in today's world too, there are so many ways to bring services to that person. You can get food delivered. You can send a masseuse over. You can get their house cleaned. Mm-hmm. I mean, all from your phone. And those are actionable, helpful things, assuming you're not intruding on their environment. That shows that you're not only thinking about them, but you're still getting stuff done for them. Yeah. These conversations that a patient and a supporter have will be emotionally charged, I'm assuming, a lot of the time.
Sometimes, yeah.
Sometimes, at least. And a lot of supporters want to tell them it's going to be okay. Mm-hmm. Tell them that they're going to get through this. Tell them that, oh, don't worry about that. When in actuality, it might not be okay. Mm-hmm. They might not get through it the way they see, and things aren't getting better. They're getting worse. Mm-hmm. So how can a supporter navigate these conversations?
Mm-hmm. Don't blow smoke. Don't give false hope. You know, don't try to feel like you have to give the sunshiny message. Mm-hmm. You know, it's not all, you know, rainbows and moonbeams. This is hard. Mm-hmm. And that it's okay to not say everything's going to be okay. Mm-hmm. You know, everything is going to be, I mean, in the grand scheme of things, I suppose everything's going to be okay. But at that point, that person, it's not true. Mm-hmm. They're not feeling it. They may not want to hear it. So don't feel like you have to come in like the cheerful police and make everything okay. Like, meet the individual where they're at. How are you doing? They might say, today's a really rough day. And then just sit with them. It might be you holding their hand. Maybe you're sitting next to them and say, you know, I am so sorry. And I'm here. Mm-hmm. And leave it at that. Mm-hmm. You know, our temptation is, it's gonna be okay.
Fix.
You know why? Because we need it to be okay.
Right.
Don't project you into the situation. This isn't your okay. It's theirs.
It's so good. What have we not talked about that we need to talk about when it comes to this topic?
I think that this topic is something that's going to become more and more relevant to more and more people as Americans get older. Mm-hmm. You know, the baby boomers are getting older in a big, big, you know, group. And, you know, getting sick is part of getting older. So I think more and more people are going to be dealing with this with their own parents, adult children, friends, extended family, coworkers, all of that. And I think that it really does become a moment for all of us, honestly, to build up that empathy muscle. That this is really about, how do you meet someone where they're at and put yourself as well as you can in their point of view, but also reflect on how your behaviors, actions, and words are impacting them. Mm-hmm. You know, in our zeal to help someone, we need to make sure it's about them, not about us. Mm-hmm. And also, we need to remember that there are people out there where this is their job, to let people know the best ways to help people who are going through chronic medical illness. More and more medical clinics, hospitals, HMOs have really, really skilled social workers, therapists, counselors, psychologists, and psychiatrists available. Mm-hmm. Talk to those people if this is your family. They're often trained on support resources, books, educational resources, support groups, therapists. Use those resources. We often get so caught up in the physicians dealing with the medical. We feel that the equally important other half to this is supporting the psychosocial piece of it.
Right.
Also, don't minimize the practical. A lot of this is structural. Just making sure that the living environment of the person makes sense, that it suits where they're at. Things are easy to find. Routines are kept. Like, whatever routine we have, those things give us comfort. Help the person keep those. The ways you can help someone are, there are many more different ways you can help a person rather than just wiping up tears and trying to be a cheerleader. Finally, the supporters need support themselves. When you're going through this and you're supporting a loved one through an illness, it can be devastating for you. The idea of potentially losing a parent or a loved one or anyone close to you, adult child, spouse, this is devastating. And so many people get so deep into the thickets of caregiving, they forget to take care of themselves. Mm-hmm. And it is very important when you're a supporter to make sure that you're also getting the services you need. So A, you can be fully present for that mm-hmm. other person, but B, so you can be fully present for yourself.
Yes, absolutely. My I think my favorite moment from this series was the realistic acceptance, or the realistic mm-hmm. hope, which mm-hmm. is the acceptance yeah. of that mm-hmm. situation, because there are things out of our control, mm-hmm. but it doesn't mean you can't move through that mm-hmm. the mm-hmm. best way for yourself.
Yes.
And
my friend, why do you seem so worried?
Ace, I'm planning an event for next weekend, eh? And I don't know how to best get people to hear about it.
Saima, don't worry about those small things. Contact Eagle FM today. Eagle FM has a dedicated team that can travel anywhere countrywide to broadcast live at any event, such as a promotion, organizational launch, anniversary, wedding, funeral, political or traditional and church events, and basically any event that you wish to broadcast on a national level. Call them now and talk to Monica at 081-270-3727 or the office number 083-288-400. Eagle FM, the eye.
I'm Dr. Becky Kennedy. I'm a clinical psychologist. I'm a mom of three. And I am the founder of the online parenting platform called Good Inside.
Chapter 1, Rethinking How We Learn, Grow, and Change.
So I began my career as a clinical psychologist, teaching parents how to give timeouts and punishments and rewards. That's how I was trained. And so there were all these moments in my private practice. Parents would come in, my kid's having a tantrum about something ridiculous. My kid is lying to me. My kid is talking back, whatever it was. And I'd say, okay, let's learn how to give a timeout. Let me teach you how to give a timeout. Let me teach you how to do a sticker chart. So I was doing that for a while. Then I had my own kid. And I also just started to reflect on my own childhood and what moments really helped me and what moments didn't. Plus, something interesting was happening in my private practice. In my private practice, beyond seeing parents to talk about issues with young kids, I was seeing adults for therapy, for couples therapy. And I felt really good about the way I was working with adults. It was a combination of, you know, internal family systems and attachment theory and somatic work. And I'm just a very practical person. So I'd always give homework for the week and so many different things. And I watched adults change their lives. And what I knew is that when adults would come to me for therapy and say things like, oh, I know I talked about asking my boss for a promotion, but I just didn't do it. Or I know we're working on my anger, but I yelled this week. I would never say to those people, give me your phone. No dessert for a week. I want you to leave my office and come back when you don't yell. I want you to leave my office and come back when you ask for that promotion. I mean, can you imagine the therapist? I would hope any client would say, well, I'm never coming back to see you again. Why would adding shame and blame help me improve my behavior? Like, literally, what's your theory for why that would even work? And it just struck me, because I'd have these sessions where I was seeing adult, and then parent of a young kid. And I just started thinking, there is no way that what adults need to change could be at complete odds with what children need to grow. And then I realized, wait, I actually think we're like causing all of these problems in childhood and trying to fix them in adulthood. It's just a remarkably inefficient system, which is not a way of saying I think we can be perfect parents. We cannot. And we're all going to struggle with things. And I hope my kids go to therapy to talk about things in their life. But we don't have to approach our kids with punishment and harshness. And if we do, why would we expect them to actually thrive in adulthood? We're actually trying to unwire all of that self-criticism and self-blame that we have as adults from our childhood so we can finally have a little bit more groundedness and perspective to actually make the productive changes we want in our life. Okay, so I was in this moment in my private practice and I was seeing parents, and I want to be honest, I was still kind of ignoring that feeling in me, like, okay, well, here's how to do a timeout. Here's how to do the sticker chart. And one day in my private practice, all I can say is the dissonance, I think, in my body, it just became too loud. I honestly couldn't focus. And I had these parents in front of me and I was teaching them how to do a timeout. And I ended up saying to them, I'm sorry, I actually don't believe anything I'm telling you right now. And not surprisingly, they looked at me and they were like, why am I paying you any money? I'm going to leave your office right now. And I was like, hold on. I feel like I just need a little bit of time. I know there's a better way. And I was actually thinking, like, I just want to take everything that I know helps adults and helps them rewire and reverse engineer it to parents to give to kids right away. But I didn't know how exactly yet. And I knew I wanted that approach to be super concrete and practical, because the one thing about timeouts and sticker charts that I think parents love, and me too, is that it just tells you what to do. We're like, well, just tell me what to do. We need something to do. But I was like, we can definitely upgrade what to do from a sticker chart and a timeout. And, you know, these parents essentially in my office were like, we're just going to go find someone else to talk to. And I was like, I totally get it. I'm so sorry. And yes, I will definitely refund you for the session. And then I started this just surge, maybe is the word, of new ideas. It's like, once I finally said this thing, I had the openness to write down so many ideas. And I think what started was just stripping away all the assumptions that we've all accepted as true. If you don't punish bad behavior, you're basically reinforcing that. Is that true? Like, I have moments that I'm not proud of with my husband, and he doesn't punish me, but I don't think he's reinforcing bad behavior. And if he said to me, Becky, if you yell at me one more time, I'm not going to eat dinner with you for a week, I just don't think that would inspire me to change in a positive way. Now, I don't expect him to be kind of a doormat in the other way, but if he said, whoa, that was not okay, and there's probably something going on with you because you don't usually act like that, and let's get to the bottom of that, I actually think that's probably what you need. And honestly, it's probably the thing that's also going to help you change. So let's figure that out together. No part of me would think, oh, my husband really lets me walk all over him. It's actually a crazy thought that we would only have if we have an incredibly negative view of humans, which I do not have. And when I started to question this approach, I was left with two foundations, really. Number one, we are born good inside. That doesn't excuse our bad behaviors at all. But inside, we are born good. And actually, that's really helpful to know, because it creates a gap between good identity and bad behaviors. And it allows us to wonder, well, why would a good person do a bad thing? And from that question, we can actually intervene much more effectively. And the other thing I realized is kids are just born with all the feelings and none of the skills to manage those feelings. And feelings without skills always come out as bad behavior. And so the idea of good inside is that we can separate behavior from identity. And in doing that, we don't become permissive parents. We actually become effective leaders who can teach kids skills they didn't have in the first place, so that not only can they improve their behavior, they can actually grow up and be resilient, successful adults. So let's jump into this idea about how behavior is different from identity, and then very practically how that idea comes to life in managing your kid's difficult behavior. The tantrum, the sibling arguing about something so silly, maybe the I hate you to your face or lying, all those hard situations. We have a habit as humans, for many reasons, of seeing someone's bad behavior and kind of assuming we know everything we need to know about the person. Someone's late to work, that person's lazy. Our kid hits another kid, they're a hitter. Right. And then even we take that moment, we tend to project forward. Oh, they're always going to be the bad kid in class. They're never going to have friends. And if you think about what's really happening here, is there's a conflation of behavior with identity. And one of the reasons this happens is behavior is observable and identity isn't. So the quickest thing for our mind to do is we see behavior hitting, we assume identity, bad kid. But actually, this isn't what's happening. This is what's happening. Behavior is identity and there's no space in between. The other reason we tend to do this is because most of us grew up in homes where we were seen as our worst behavior. Nobody saw us as a good kid identity who was having a hard time behavior, where those things were separate. So we've actually wired those two things together. One of the life-changing ideas, I think, around good inside is to separate behavior from identity. And this is as life-changing in parenting your kid as it is in relating to yourself, as it is in your marriage or your work relationship. And what's really important is people say, oh, so you're just letting your kid off the hook. They're a good kid having a hard time, so it's okay that they're hitting a sibling. No, Not at all. I've never seen my kid hit another kid and say, oh, let out that anger. You're a good kid letting out anger. I love it. That would be so bizarre. Seeing my kid as a good kid having a hard time allows me to intervene more like a coach than someone who's just delivering punishment. That's really important. Because when you realize, hold on a second, I have a good kid having a hard time. In the moment, I'm going to swoop in. I might even say, whoa, I'm not going to let you hit your brother. I'm going to pick my kid up and carry them to the side. And I might, if I'm on my game, even say, you're a good kid having a hard time and I'm going to help you through it. It's one of the most life-changing things for kids to hear. And so many parents have said that simple phrase saying to their kid, you're a good kid having a hard time, has de-escalated a hard situation in a way nothing else they've ever tried has. And if you think about it, that makes sense. Think about your own hard moment and think about the way people look at you like you're a bad person. Maybe it's happened in a recent argument with a partner or at work and you just get this look like, I see your bad behavior and I kind of am treating you like a bad person. We have shame, we spiral, we get worse. There's nothing more powerful in adulthood as someone saying to you some version of, hold on a second, you're a good person. You just said something that I have a feeling you didn't really mean. Let's take a moment to cool off. We can try this again. In our hardest moments, we are all desperate to have someone else see the inherent goodness inside of us. And sometimes we need someone else to see it before we can access it ourselves. Let's take lying as a situation. Very triggering when our kids lie to us. Recently had a parent say, I have a Nest camera. I saw my teenager steal money from my drawer. I asked my teenager about it. He said, nope, I didn't do it. Separate but related, never ask someone a question you know the answer to. You're actually just trying to catch them in a lie, which makes anyone defensive. But if we think about this as a good kid having a hard time, we see it very differently. It doesn't mean I'm going to throw my kid a party for stealing money, not at all. But I'd probably say something like this. Hey, I saw that you took money from my drawer. Hold on a second. This is not about to be a punishment. That would be way too much short-term thinking. I know you're a good kid. And there must have been something going on that you didn't think you could come ask me for money for whatever you wanted it for. And it's true. I might end up saying no, but it's really important that we have the type of relationship where you know you could come to me. Honestly, that's probably only becoming more and more important as you get older and things get even trickier in your life. So what was going on for you? I just want to actually understand. Understanding what was happening is so much more important than the behavior itself, because that's the only way we can get ahead of everything that's going to happen after. Now, I know what parents think. We traditionally think, isn't that permitting the bad behavior? Understanding the reasons for a bad behavior is not at all the same thing as permitting behavior. And we don't think about that in any other way. If you think about a kid on a basketball team who's a really good player, but has an awful couple games, and you think about the coach saying, hold on a second, I'm taking you out for this game, but tomorrow let's go to the gym together. Let's really figure this out. What's going on with your layups and your passing? Everything is off. I'm on your team. I want to understand what's happening. I just don't know one parent who would say, I don't want that coach for my kid. That coach is permitting bad behavior. That coach is basically telling my kid it's okay to have a bad game. It's bananas. None of us think that. You know what we all think? That's the coach I want. That coach actually is trying to get to the source of what was happening, because that's the only way you can actually improve behavior. So a lot of people ask me, reward charts, timeouts, stickers. I feel like these have worked to improve behavior. Like, why would I depart from these methods? So first of all, I'd call into question how effective these methods are. And also a lot of studies that show short-term impact don't tell the whole story of child development. Anything that's fear-based, sometimes you can get kids to short-term comply. I don't think that's data worth bragging about. What we know is that childhood is an amazing time for kids to learn the skills they are going to need for life. I don't know if any of us really think I learned skills by being punished. You do have a model of what not to do, I guess, but nobody's helping you know what to do. Let's take jealousy as an example. Why do kids hit siblings? Sometimes they're just jealous. Oh, my sibling has a truck that I really want to play with in this moment. I'm jealous. I'm frustrated. I don't have the skills to manage those feelings. So it comes out as a hit. Now I get a timeout for not hitting. And is that going to work? Well, fast forward many, many years. I don't think I'm going to be jealous of my sibling in my 20s that they have a toy truck that I don't have. But you better bet that when I see my sibling have a job that feels more successful than my job or own a home that is bigger than the home I can afford, I'm going to feel pretty jealous and frustrated. And if I don't have skills to manage those feelings, I don't know if it would come out as a hit, but it would come out as pretty toxic behavior. Skills aren't gifted to us with age. We don't magically become able to manage our emotions when we become 18. That's not how it works. We learn how to manage our emotions through our earliest relationships. I always tell parents, kids can't learn to tolerate feelings we can't tolerate in them. So if my kid is jealous and frustrated and that comes out as bad behavior and all I do is send them to their room, maybe short term for some kids, for people pleasing kids only, not for the non-people pleasers. They just escalate when you punish them. My kid might look like, oh, I'm going to change my behavior. I'm just so terrified of my parent being upset with me. And I can get my kid to comply. I always find this interesting. I've never met one parent who says, oh, I'm so proud of my 30-year-old daughter. She is so compliant. She does everything people ask her to do. She is so attentive to what everyone wants of her that she's just always taking care of everyone else and doesn't really ever take care of her own needs or even know what they are. I've never heard that, although that is the thing that leads to so many women essentially breaking down. You don't just get the skills to manage your own feelings at a certain developmental milestone. And punishment and rewards are purely behavior focused. They do not teach skills. Just like we don't punish and reward kids into learning how to swim, we teach them how to swim. We teach them skills. And importantly with swimming, we understand that just because I'm teaching a kid a skill, it doesn't mean my kid's going to swim tomorrow. It's actually interesting. We tolerate the length of time it learns how to swim as a parent, even though those are very expensive lessons a lot of us put money toward. We know this is going to take time. And swimming is a skill. I think that's actually a very important life skill. Emotion regulation is an even more important life skill. And so how I want parents to start thinking is not just in terms of short-term behavioral compliance, which, by the way, works against someone later on. But actually, I have this window of time where I can actually teach my kids the skills that are actually going to be the most important skills of their life. And punishments and rewards just don't teach skills. So many times I'm asked, is good inside gentle parenting? I actually think the term gentle parenting has probably been misrepresented, but it's just not a term I identify with. So I'm just going to put it over here. And one of the reasons I don't identify with it is I think some of our most important parenting moments, the word gentle just isn't a word I would use to describe the feeling I'm accessing in that moment. Some of my best parenting moments, even though they're the hardest, is when I do something that I just know needs to be done and is for my kid's best interest long-term, but requires a lot of trickiness and hard feelings in the moment. And I think those moments call for sturdiness, like a lot of conviction. And really, if we zoom out, I think good inside is just a leadership approach. So it's really a sturdy leadership approach. I love the word sturdy, and I'm going to define it. But one of the reasons I love it is it has a feeling associated with it. And it takes it out of just being a word, and it does something in our body. If you think about someone in your life who you consider sturdy, you can kind of conjure up this thing about them where you can kind of locate them like, oh, I know where you are. But they also were able to connect to other people. There's something happening there in just the feeling of the word. So if I think about a sturdy leader, they're able to do two things at once. They're able to ground their decisions in their own values. They can embody their appropriate authority in a situation. So they're connected to themselves. At the same time, a sturdy leader is able to understand other people, hear them out, maybe even understand their reactions and feelings. They're able to connect to other people. A sturdy leader at the same time can connect to themselves and someone else. So let me explain a metaphor because it's actually the best way of bringing this to life. So imagine you're on a plane and you're a passenger. I'm a passenger too, and it gets very, very turbulent. So turbulent that everyone is kind of screaming in the passenger cabin. Oh my goodness. Oh my goodness. Okay. Let's imagine three announcements you might hear from a pilot. Okay. Announcement number one. Stop screaming back there. You're making a big deal out of nothing. You all ruin everything for me. Stop being dramatic. Now, I think we all know that wouldn't really make me feel better. First of all, I'm wondering, is the pilot missing the intense turbulence? And is the pilot so threatened by my being nervous that it kind of throws them off? Eesh. That's kind of like when we say to our kids when they're melting down about not having ice cream for breakfast, you're so dramatic. You're making a big deal out of nothing. We kind of really lean with invalidation. I'm not able to connect to the other person and see that their reality is real for them, even if it's not real for me. Okay, that's not the announcement we want. Here's pilot two, also not the announcement we want. Oh no, turbulence, I'm opening up the cockpit doors. If anyone back there kind of knows what to do, please come in. Now, if you're like me, you're not even scared of the turbulence anymore. You're just terrified that this person is your pilot. So what's happening there? The pilot loses themselves. In the first kind of situation, they lose connection to someone else. In the second, they lose connection to themselves. They see your feelings almost as contagious. You're nervous, that means I'm nervous. And we're in this exact same situation together. That's kind of when we say to our kid who's melting down over breakfast, fine, have ice cream for breakfast. Just stop.
Rita vazende kize imba izwezi pili. Lue kerize mikwaye nguyencha kukona kunolofaza kwa nkufisa hamo chualo ni mata amska vwana kare. Kana mitukiserize kuvona msevelezo wa imba ye, mufumane lisevelezo ze izwezi pili ze kakulifa fela mashering alika na 36 na million dollars kakweli. Kapa kami kwaye kutesi fafasi ye tatama, 5% machipisa hamungo tisari kwerize talu, 10% machipisa hamungo tisari kwerize sirela, 25% machipisa hamungo tisari kwerize lishumi peri. Muketeri kwerize zo movata kulimukone kukala kuikola zende zeo imba imiswa lezi fama chipisa. Imba, toku kubukaniri fasi kaufela. Mwipe kwa lisevelezo za imba kachenu kulimukone kuikola zende kaufela.
Oh, tantruming. And importantly, I'm not making that decision because I actually think I want to give my kid ice cream for breakfast, which could be my decision. I'm doing it because really, really hate seeing my kid upset. Their feelings kind of come into my body, and I just want that feeling for me to stop. Okay, let's get to the third pilot, because I think this is the pilot we all want. Hey, I hear you screaming back there. I get it. You're nervous because it's so turbulent. That's okay. Scream away. Do your thing. I know what I'm doing. I've been through this before. And I'm going to stop this announcement now and go back to doing my job. And I know I'm going to get us to our destination shortly. Interestingly, the turbulence could stay the exact same, maybe even get a little worse. But suddenly I have a deep breath of relief. Why? Two things that sturdy leaders do. They see your emotional reality as real and they care about it while they are not overwhelmed by it themselves. That means they actually have a boundary between you and them. I can empathize with your feeling precisely because I'm not taking on the feeling myself. I can see that you believe you're in this storm. And at the same time, I can see calm and hope and safety on the other side. I can do both of those things at once. That's kind of when we say to our kid who's melting down about wanting ice cream for breakfast, I get it. You really want ice cream. Oh, I would want that too. You wish you could have ice cream. And ice cream's not an option, sweetie. It's okay if you're upset. We're going to figure this out. And when you want, let me know something else you could have for breakfast. I can see my kid's emotional reality, but I'm not taken over by it. And I have this sturdiness in the middle of the storm. And that's exactly the type of leadership our kids are looking for from us.
Chapter 2, Understanding Our Own Factory Settings.
So attachment theory really influences a lot of how I talk about day-to-day moments in parenting. Attachment theory was popularized by John Bowlby and Mary Ainsworth a very long time ago. And really the foundation of attachment theory is the idea that the nature of the relationship we form with our kid in their earliest years is something that impacts them for the rest of their life. Connection for kids is the key to their survival. It's really an evolutionary force. Attachment is the key evolutionary force for kids because for a very, very long time, more than almost any other animal species, human child truly can't survive on their own. Yes, they need food, shelter, water, but they get that from their parent. And so kids are always looking, what allows me to stay connected to my parents? What parts of me are lovable and understandable? And what parts of me kind of exist in aloneness? And those parts that exist in aloneness become very dangerous, right? And often then have to get acted out. They're really learning with us, who am I? What feelings am I allowed to have? What can I expect from people around me when we're going through hard situations? Is it okay to be mad at someone I love? Is it okay to mess up in a relationship? Do I have a pathway to recover? Or is that something that seems almost unrecoverable? What parts of me get love and connection? And what parts of me are kind of met with, we don't do that in this family. And I kind of have to learn, ooh, danger, put them away. And I take those lessons from my parent because in a way, my parent is my world. And I start to generalize them as I get older to the world. And so the nature of a relationship our kid forms with us becomes kind of a blueprint. Or a friend of mine named Miley calls it her kid's factory settings, where I love that because we can change factory settings. We can change a default. And at the same time, the factory settings our kid goes into adulthood with are pretty powerful. So, for example, when my kid has a meltdown about something that I think is small in my adult life, but matters in my kid life, I don't know, maybe, oh, I'm not with Sophia in class. I can't go to school this year. My kid's melting down. They're crying. It's all your fault. Of course, I have nothing to do with it. But if my general pattern of responding to this is something like, you're being ridiculous. If you keep crying, I'm taking away, I don't know, fill in the blank with whatever it is. My kid does not learn. I'm having a big reaction to classes in second grade and I can respond more calmly next time. No. They learn a couple of things. Number one, it's not safe in my closest relationships to feel upset. When I'm very upset about something in my life, I should expect the people close to me to be very turned off by that and want nothing to do with me. That's one lesson they learn. Another lesson they learn might be, oh, maybe I don't know how I feel. My parent did always tell me I overreacted to things. So I guess other people have a better sense of how I feel than I do. Now, if we just take those two lessons and we fast forward, this might sound obvious, but I always think about it. We have the same body today as we had our childhood. It's a collection of all of the memories. And our body likes to generalize. Just like you learn to look both ways before you cross the street early on, you could be in a totally different environment in adulthood. And if someone said, you don't have to look both ways here, you can just cross the road, cars won't hurt you. Your body literally wouldn't allow you to do that because it took an early lesson around safety and has generalized. It's true. I've never been to Tokyo, but I'm going to assume the same thing is true as it's always been. I'm going to look both ways to keep me safe. So now let's say my kid is no longer in my house. And I'm making this up, is married to someone and they're really upset about a bad meeting at work. Their body's going to kind of do an inventory. Is this safe, let's say, for me to talk to my husband about? Or am I basically going to expect my husband to tell me I'm making a big deal out of nothing? So then I don't talk about it. But the feelings remain. You know what probably happens? I don't know. I'm probably snapping at my husband about something totally irrelevant. I'm probably super short with my kids. I'm probably acting it out in some other ways because our feelings don't lie. That's one kind of legacy of attachment. Another legacy is when we invalidate our kids all the time, which sounds like you're dramatic. You're making a big deal out of nothing. This is a disproportionate reaction. They doubt their emotions in really dangerous ways. I'm just going to go for it because I'm pretty direct. Let's picture a girl who's now at a bar at age 20 something, 25, and someone comes up to them and they're kind of flirty. It feels fun, stranger. They don't know. And then it goes a step further. Come home with me. And that girl, let's say, initially has a feeling in her body like, ooh, I don't know about this. Well, what's the attachment lessons that she might have learned early on in totally different situations, but the same circuits? Other people do tend to know how I should feel better than I do. And then she hears, Come on, don't make such a big deal out of it. It's just going to be fun. It's true. I do tend to make a big deal out of nothing. And I know it's so easy to say, that is crazy. That has nothing to do with freaking out about classes in our body, in the inventory that happens around, do I trust my emotions? Do I listen to what's happening? Is something that's a big deal to me. Even if it's not a big deal to someone else, can I go with my gut or do I use someone else's reaction as a barometer of what I should do? Those are absolutely the same situations inside of our body. Attachment theory is this idea that our earliest relationships form the blueprint for our later relationships. But internal family systems is basically the idea that inside our bodies, we have many, many parts of us. So if you put that together, you could also say the way we develop parts when we're young will also play out in our adult relationships when we're older. And what internal family systems posits, which is so powerful, is that all of our different parts came from an adaptive place. They were all trying to figure out in our earliest years, what do I need to do to survive and adapt in my family of origin? So for example, let's say anger was not something you could safely express toward your parent. The truth is anger is a powerful emotion. So when we're young, we tend not to say to our parent, I'm angry at you. We tend to say, I hate you, right? Or you're the worst dad in the world. You don't do anything for me. Even maybe after our parents just took us to an amusement park, right? Now, when that feeling comes out, if we were met with some type of danger, right? Go to your room. You don't say something like that to me. No, insert punishment here for a week or maybe worse. Maybe we were hit. Then what does my body as a kid have to learn? I actually don't learn. I should have expressed my anger in a better way. I actually learn anger is not a safe emotion. If I just didn't feel angry, I would have been a lot safer in my home. Now, from an internal family systems perspective, how do we stop anger? It's kind of hard. It's a natural emotion. I develop a new part. It would actually be called, and so beautiful, a protector part that's trying to protect me from feeling that anger. It's trying to really help me stay safe. Now, the protector part might have to use some extreme methods. It might need to say to me, you're a horrible, ungrateful person. No one else would feel this way. And I know that sounds mean. Dr. Becky, that doesn't sound adaptive, but anger is pretty powerful. And if it was so scary to express anger in your home, your body actually figured out how to develop a part that was equally as powerful to shut it down. Now let's fast forward 20 years, 40 years. I think we know, even theoretically, we all get angry at the people we love. That happens. But just like attachment theory teaches us, what happens in our adult relationships becomes a lot of reactivation of our earliest lessons. So let's say you start to feel angry toward your partner, but then there's this protector part that's talking to you the same way as when you were 8. It doesn't know that it's 2025 or whatever year it is now. It still thinks it's, I don't know, 1980. So it says to you, don't be angry. Do not appreciate your partner. Something's wrong with you. So you shut down anger because of this protector part that used to protect you, maybe isn't protecting you anymore, but it thinks it's protecting you. And then we all know what happens. We shut it down. And then there's a moment, oh boy, it comes out with such explosiveness, not because anything's wrong with us, but because we didn't kind of let out the steam earlier. Now, when I talk about this with people say, okay, so we just got to like get rid of the protector parts, right? Well, we don't. Because from an internal family systems perspective, that part developed for a reason. We actually have to start by thanking that part. Thank you for all the years you kept me safe. You are right. You were doing a really important job. Expressing anger was not safe. And nobody helped me learn to express anger. And nobody gave me a runway as a young kid to know, well, of course, Becky's not going to express anger well. She's only 5. That was not the case. And so you were so crafty for so long in figuring out some way of shutting anger down. Now I'm here to tell you I'm not 5 anymore. I'm in a different situation. And I'm going to ask you for some moments to kind of step back a little bit so I can practice expressing my anger in healthy ways, even to people I love. And over time, you might get a little worried, but we're kind of going to figure this out together. And that would be kind of an IFS-based intervention where we're learning to connect to our parts, understand their original function, have compassion, and in doing that, they stop having such hold on us. And so this IFS perspective has really influenced how I think about development, how I help parents, but also some of my favorite interventions to actually teach parents to do with children is IFS based and inspired. If we can help our kids learn to kind of recognize their parts early, that's one of the most adaptive things that leads to resilience later on. So all the time in adulthood, we are faced with these things that we become curious about. Oh, is that one of the reasons I tend to act this way? Let's talk about attachment. Whenever I feel really upset, even maybe at my partner, I tend to pull away. I kind of push them away. If I start to learn, if I do that, at some point in my life, was that adaptive? Might have been adaptive in my earliest years to have learned when I'm feeling big feelings, your best bet, it's not ideal, but your best bet is to pull away. That is your first moment of like immense power going forward in your adult life. We can't change things before we understand things. Like we always say that at Good Inside, we have to understand before we intervene. And understanding doesn't change things on its own, but it's a necessary first step. So you might reflect, hold on a second. This style that I even play out with my husband, with my kid, with someone at work. Yeah, there's stuff going on in the present moment, but also it might be some type of reactivation or early pattern from the past. Then the next step I think is, can I learn about it? The thing that stops us from learning about it is we feel like there's so much shame. I encourage people to kind of take this realization or curiosity and almost like put it on a shelf and look at it. That's interesting. I wonder what else I could know about that. I think I'm going to learn about you. I think I'm going to take this book. There's so many books about attachment. There's so much we teach at Good Inside about something called reparenting, about triggers, which is not at all about blaming your parents. Blaming to me is such a powerless move. That's not what we do. It's actually about understanding. Why am I the way I am? And why do I do things that I don't want to do, but it just keeps happening? And if we can learn about that, then we can actually start to talk about it with someone. I might say to my partner, you know what I've learned about myself? When I'm upset, even though I kind of could really use some support, in the past, before I even knew you, I never really got that support. So one of the things I would do is kind of pull away. Do you ever feel like I do that to you? Maybe like I get really, really snappy and even mean, which is not okay. And then later we realize I'd actually been having this really hard week at work. Your partner might look at you and be like, yeah, which actually it can feel hard, but I promise you it can be this beautiful moment of a new type of connection when you're almost both looking at this thing in the shelf, like, yeah, that's kind of true. And I think in the best partnerships, both people are understanding how my earliest attachments influence what I'm bringing today. And you learn about yourself and you learn about each other. Because it's amazing when a partner can start to see, oh, I think she's doing that pulling away thing. It doesn't mean it's my job to make this better, but actually having a little clarity, I might say to my partner in a hard moment, hey, look, the last week has been really hard. I feel like you've been really snippy and let's figure that out. I also know based on our conversations, there might be something hard and vulnerable you're going through. You can talk to me about that. This is not the same as early on. And I know it's going to feel hard because it's new. Why don't you take a moment? Because the snippiness and snapping at me, I know that's not the version of you you want to continue. And I know it's going to be a leap of faith for you to try something new. But I know we're both working on this. And I'm going to ask you to do that. Why don't we find a time and you can tell me what's really going on? And this is where our earliest attachments give us information to empower ourselves. And in no way do they kind of put us in some type of prison.
Chapter 3, How to Regulate Your Emotions at Any Age.
there are things we can do to improve our emotion regulation skills. Number one is actually just realizing it's a skill. I think parenting is a skill too. That's actually what everything we do at Good Inside is based on. We've been told forever, parenting comes naturally. You should just know what to do. I hear this from parents all the time. I'm struggling with my kid. They're having these tantrums. I'm yelling them all the time. And then they say, yeah, I'm getting tips on Instagram. I read a book here or there. But when you really realize, hold on a second, this is a skill. Any other area of my life that I really care about, I invest in learning skills. I get some professional help. I practice. That's actually so empowering. That's a sign of strength. It's just that parenting has always been told to us is something that just comes naturally, which is why we feel shame and we stay alone when we're struggling. That's actually the biggest thing I hope to change. And so, yes, there are so many things we can do to work on our parenting or to work on emotion regulation, which is definitely a part of parenting. Attachment theory and emotion regulation are deeply connected concepts. Kids are born with all of the emotions and none of the skills to manage those emotions. That gap explains why kids and adults act out. It's when emotions are greater than skills. But the thing about these skills that's different than some other skills is they're rarely just taught in a textbook or in a classroom. Kids learn skills to manage their emotions through their attachment with their parents.
Did you hear that? Okay. So, ladies and gentlemen, I will meet you guys again tomorrow and we'll continue with our conversations. But for now, take it easy. Take that chill pill. Take a dive within your emotions and let it be. From me, the matriarch, I bid you guys a good night and see you later.